Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Brown University pre-college programs, where high school students can prepare for college success, experience college life, and make new friends from around the world. More than 300 courses are available. precollege.brown.edu.
This is Boston Public Radio. We're replaying some of our conversations. We kick things off with New York Times Magazine staff writer and lecturer at Yale Law School, Emily Bazelon, whose latest book looks at the causes of mass incarceration.
Houston Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Or good afternoon, I should
Whatever
say.
Whatever it is. So in the United States, crime is down, but our incarceration rates are still among the highest in the world. Nearly 2.2 million adults were held in America's prisons and jails at the end of 2016. That means if the U.S. prison population were a city, it would be among the country's largest, bigger than Philly or Dallas. How we got here is the subject of Emily Bazelon's new book, which makes the case that prosecutors bear most of the guilt for dragging the country into this situation. She also says they are the ones who can dig us out. It's titled Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Emily, great to see you again. How are you?
I'm good. Great to see you. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to see you, too. This is you've done a great job here. Your book just sucks everybody in right from the opening pages. And I thought years ago, reading that Michelle Alexander book about the new Jim Crow, you've got, the new Jim Crow plus corruption in the DA's office. So talk about, I think most of us have this incorrect idea, really, that, you know, you've got the judge, you've got the defense attorney, and you've got the prosecutor. It's like three legs of the chair. But your whole thesis is that the prosecutors wield much more power. So explain that to us.
Yeah, I think most of us assume that the defense lawyer and the prosecutor are like the bottom pegs of the triangle, and they're on an equal playing field, and they have the same kind of bargaining power. And the judge, who's the neutral referee, is standing above them making the key decisions. But starting in the 1980s, when sentences rose, and this was partly a response to crime and partly because politicians figured out how to make voters really scared about crime. So sentences start to rise, and in particular, we start to have mandatory minimum sentences. We did that to take discretion out of the system, right? The idea is you tie the hands of the judge, you get rid of soft sentences. The problem is that you can't eliminate discretion from the system. It moved to prosecutors because once you know what the mandatory sentence is, then it depends on the charge and the plea bargain. And charging and plea bargain are fully in the hands of prosecutors. So we really shifted this balance of power. Prosecutors who have the job of winning convictions are now in a lot of ways more powerful than neutral judges.
And give us a sense of what percentage of criminal cases ultimately end up in plea bargain resolution.
So almost in a lot of state court systems, we're now above 95% of convictions being obtained through plea bargains. So there's like a significant chunk, like 25 to 30% of cases that get dismissed. That's when a defense lawyer has time and can use the tactic of delay often to get a prosecutor to take a closer look or just show what the legal flaws and weaknesses are with the case. But if you get convicted, it is almost always by making a deal that the prosecutor controls rather than by going to trial.
You know, I mentioned this to you last night on television. You bring this whole subject to life in a terrific way with this guy, Kevin, who is a young African-American who is arrested on a gun charge. And there's a DA in Brooklyn. His name is Gonzalez. We'll pair them up and talk about them. And you compare that to the treatment of Nora Jackson, who is an 18-year-old who is indicted for and convicted of murdering her mother. And Amy, it's Amy Weinrich right down there, the prosecutor there. Start with the Kevin story, and then let's move to the contrast for what happened in Tennessee, if you can.
So Kevin gets charged with gun possession. He's in a friend's apartment. There's a gun. It's not his. The cops know it's not his because they saw his friend flash it on Facebook the day before. But in the moment of the police showing up, Kevin has this rash impulse. He's going to pick up the gun and save everybody by flushing it down the toilet. You can tell we're talking about a 19-year-old kid here, right? Doesn't work. He gets arrested. And in New York, gun possession is a serious violent felony. So you have a lot of prosecutorial power over this kid with a prosecutor's office that is interested in trying to give second chances when they can. And this is a political risk that Eric Gonzalez, the DA, is taking, because once we categorize people as violent felons, everyone in the system gets very nervous about them. If you let them out and they hurt someone, you're in big trouble. But we see Gonzalez take a chance on Kevin, and then I followed Kevin over a year and a half to see what would happen to him.
Tell us about Eric Gonzalez. We have a Rachel Rollins.
Before I get to Eric Gonzalez, one of the things I really loved about the way you set this up is when you, in the beginning of the book, when you introduced Kevin, I think a lot of people think, oh, these kids are all a bunch of bums, you know, shooting each other and all this. You show how he kind of almost passively gets kind of sucked into a situation. He doesn't really have many choices. He's in a very difficult place to begin with. So just talk about that a little bit. He didn't set out to be any kind of criminal.
Yeah, so I showed up in this specialized gun court just for gun possession charges in Brooklyn. And I figured these were, like, bad kids. Like, it's bad to have a gun. Guns are dangerous. What I found was a lot of people talking about having guns for protection. And I tried to understand, like, what does that mean? What is the circumstances of your life that you feel threatened and you think having an illegal weapon is the way that's going to make you safer? You're wrong. You're misguided. But, like, what has happened to you? And what does the system have to offer you? If you go to prison and you come back out, are you going to be better off or worse off? What's the way to really make the community safer and your own life better? So, yes, I was trying to make Kevin a real three-dimensional person who's wrestling with a lot of struggles, like, you know, like a lot of teenagers.
Yeah, his father left him. He's in this project where everybody's getting shot all the time, where he's getting jumped at 13, and I think again a couple of years later. So he's very vulnerable, and that's what I think is really important for people.
And Eric Gonzalez, this new DA, as you call him, reform-oriented DA, recognized this. How did he decide to treat this case?
So they give Kevin a chance to do what's called a diversion program, which means that he's going to plead guilty. He has a 2-year prison sentence hanging over his head, but it's effectively suspended. And so he goes home and he works with a social worker. He's supposed to get a job. He's supposed to kind of try to make his life better. And I think, Marjorie, what you were just pointing to is something we see over and over again. We often think victims are a separate group from people who commit violence, but actually they overlap. And so what you see with Kevin is someone who's been victimized, who's gotten beaten up, who felt under siege, and yet he's trying, especially working with the social worker he develops a very trusting relationship with, to get his GED, to get a job, to start taking the next step to becoming a full adult.
You know, one last thing about Brooklyn before we go down to Tennessee. Rachel Rollins is sort of the Eric Gonzalez of here. Gonzalez is the Rachel Rollins of Brooklyn, obviously recently elected Suffolk County DA. I know you met her yesterday. And there was a lot of blowback when she came out with this, we're not going to prosecute these 15 low-level crimes, which, by the way, we learned subsequently was pretty much what was going on before as a de facto situation, just not announced. What kind of blowback did Gonzalez get from his sort of his reform-oriented agenda?
Gonzalez has a similar moment. He and his predecessor say, we're not going to prosecute most marijuana offenses. The police say, well, we're going to keep arresting everyone. And I think what you see here is a struggle over resources. So the resources of the prosecutor's office of the court system, they're finite. So it's true about the police, too. If we spend a lot of money prosecuting low-level offenses, we have fewer resources to spend on major crimes. And we live in a country in which we only solve 60% of murders nationwide. In a lot of cities, the rate is even lower. So one of the arguments...
We have the worst clearance rate in the country when you compare a black person who's murdered,
a victim.
Black victim, the worst in the United States. I'm sorry to interrupt, Jim.
No, I mean, I think that's part of the story that is really important to tell, and these new prosecutors are making the argument, look, we need the trust of the community in order to solve these crimes. We need people to report crimes. We need them to show up as witnesses. And if they don't trust the police in the system because they've been jacked up or they've seen other people, their friends and family, treated unfairly, that actually makes people less safe, not more safe.
Well, one of the things, too, and I mentioned the Michelle Alexander, the new Jim Crow thing before, that you know, many people have made the argument that, oh, now that white people in the suburbs are having problems with opioids, now suddenly we have to divert everybody and nobody's a criminal, everybody has a disease. And you see, when you talked about the gun court chapter where you got de Blasio talking about that, whatever it was, Project Task Force or Fast Track or whatever it was, the same kind of blowback. But it you make clear, too, that there is a different attitude toward African-American defendants. It seems pretty clear. Nobody's looking at this as a sociological problem, except maybe the Gonzalez guy and the other guy, Thompson, that died, that was an African-American, and Gonzalez grew up as a Latino in a poor neighborhood, too. You don't get that this is a sociological problem.
Well, I think one of the things you're touching on is some of the new DAs are people of color, and that itself is unusual. We have a prosecutorial system in this country where if you look nationwide, about 80% of people are white men who are elected to DA. So part of what the movement to elect new prosecutors is doing is putting people in office who look like America, and in Eric Gonzalez's case, who come from the same streets in Brooklyn as these defendants. And so he's able to see, I think, that these kids with guns are a lot like the kids who are getting prosecuted during the war on drugs. Kids who, their lives are confused and they need help, but they don't necessarily need to go to prison.
Okay, can we do a little contrast here, as you do, Nora Jackson and the prosecutor there in the case, Amy Weinrich?
So my story in Brooklyn is about, like, the ordinary legal use of prosecutorial power. And the story in Memphis is a story about a hard-charging traditional law and order prosecutor who focuses like a laser on this 18-year-old girl whose mother has been brutally stabbed. There are no other suspects. There's a lot of DNA evidence. It goes away for testing in the lab. Suspicion starts to swirl around Nora, partly because she's an orphan. Her father had actually been killed in this bizarre coincidence a year and a half earlier. Instead of
unsolved, right?
Unsolved. Instead of thinking that those killings could be connected, the police start hearing people complain that Nora was out all night, the night her mom was killed. She can't account for a couple hours in the middle of the night. That starts to seem very suspicious to them. Nora's charged with her mother's murder by the prosecutor, Amy Weinrich. Then the DNA results come back, and they actually exclude Nora from the crime scene. There are a couple of other profiles in there. Nobody goes to look for those people. Instead, Nora is prosecuted, and Amy Weinrich, very skillful trial lawyer, succeeds in convicting her. But then that conviction gets overturned because of constitutional errors that Weinrich made in the trial.
Errors is a kind word, I should say. Say what she did or didn't do.
So there are two things that happened. One is that she withheld evidence that could have helped Nora prove her innocence. And that is a foundational constitutional protection we all have, right? The state, the police are the ones who gather evidence. You need to know what they've got that could help you. The second thing she does is, so Nora chose not to testify. That's something a lot of defense lawyers, advice they give their clients. They're afraid to put you on the stand. They don't know how you're going to handle it. You're supposed to have that, right? It's in the Fifth Amendment. You don't have to incriminate yourself. At the end of the trial, the sort of key closing moment, Weinrich turns to the jury and she says, just tell us where you were, Nora. As if to say, like, you didn't explain your whereabouts and to kind of hold against her decision not to testify. For those two, they're really examples of prosecutorial misconduct. The Tennessee Supreme Court overturned Nora's conviction, and then I sort of take her story from there.
Can you just have, for one second, you started with error, and then you mentioned this thought. From what I understand, the principal witness against her sent an email, a letter, or something that Weinrich's assistant allegedly forgot was in his pocket.
Yeah, forgot.
Or something.
Yes.
Again, a document from the principal prosecution witness, and all of a sudden it appeared too late, and then they turn it over. And that was that bought by whatever the judicial, whatever the conduct commission is that ultimately decided her fate, Weinrich's fate?
Yeah, so, you know, what you're talking about here is an office with a pattern of constitutional violations and of not disclosing evidence. And so I think your skepticism, which I completely understand, is this problem of if a prosecutor says, oh, wait a second, I had this piece of evidence, but I just didn't turn it over, do you get suspicious, or do you think, like, okay, well, this is a lawyer, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt? And you're right, there's an ethics trial in the book where this prosecutor is effectively being prosecuted by the legal profession, by the bar in Tennessee. And yet, he has these three peers sitting in judgment over him. They're very reluctant to hold him accountable. And so I don't want to give the whole story away, but there is a chapter about that that I think shows how hard it is for prosecutors to be held accountable when they make mistakes.
We're talking to Emily Bazelon. Her book is Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Speaking of transformation in your title, how do we change the national mindset from a good prosecutor is the toughest prosecutor to a good prosecutor is one in the Gonzalez-Rollins mold? How do we do that?
So we have this window of opportunity right now because crime is really down. And I think that is opening a lot of people's minds to this question of like, okay, so what does make us safe? And what's a worthwhile way to, you know, use our resources? Are we better off continuing to have mass incarceration, which I think a lot of people know at this point is causing a lot of harm and costs enormous amounts of taxpayer money?
Which is why there's bipartisan action happening on this, or at least bipartisan discussion.
Exactly. I think the bipartisan support for reducing the jail and prison population starts from that premise. And then this question of like, well, what does make communities safer? Is it that, you know, the cops are on kids and everyone can be punished at a drop of the hat? Or do poor communities where there's more crime and where the criminal justice system focuses, would they be better served by, like, having more mental health treatment and better social services and better schools and access to jobs? Really the same things all of us want, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's why I said before a lot of this is a sociological problem. So we talked about Rachel Rollins before, the new DA in Suffolk County, who's gotten a lot of pushback from the cops and from the public safety guy in the governor's office saying this is she's taking the wrong approach and blah, blah, blah. The same sort of thing we talked about happening in New York City. But as Jim pointed out when we were talking about your coming in this morning, she could get voted out, you know, the next time around. It could be back to the... We have had a history of a lot of Irish prosecutors, DAs in Suffolk County. Dan Connolly was the last one before.
A lot of Irish columnists, too, by the
yeah,
way, Margaret.
Yeah, that's right. That used to be the joke in Boston. Every detective had, you know, it was O'Flanagan, O'Leary, O'Sullivan, or something like that. Anyway, so how do you keep this going? Because I think a lot of this hysteria about crime, too, came out of the crack epidemic when there was so much violence against children of people that were crack addicted, and there was so much violence in general. And how do you keep it going?
Well, I think that, you know, if Rollins does the job that the voters who supported her want her to do, right, she's answering to a different constituency. It was really communities of color, people impacted directly by the system, who came out and elected her. She is accountable to them and to the rest of the county, too. But I think if people feel like her approach is successful, if it feels like the community is still safe and also healthier in a kind of sociological way, that is going to help her get reelected. And then you see more a sort of longer path change. And then maybe eventually you see cities like Boston become models that convince state legislators, you know what, we don't need all these mandatory sentences. We don't need to be spending all our money on prisons.
You know, by the way, I don't want you to give away too much of your book, but I am curious because... Needless to say, you read it, you develop a sort of animus toward Amy Weirich. You don't like her much, the long-distance brother, mother of four with the blonde hair, was very ambitious and looking for, you know, did she get into trouble over this situation?
No, to the contrary. So after Nora's trial, Amy Weirich was elected as the district attorney in Memphis, and she was reelected in 2014 to an 8-year term. So she isn't up for election until 2022. She's really been able to ride this out, at least so far.
You know, I am a cup totally empty kind of guy on most of these things, even though I'd like to think I'm hopeful. I mentioned to you last night, I'm sure you knew about it before. We did a lot of shows with Carol Rose, head of the Civil Liberties Union here, Rahsaan Hall, who ran the What a Difference a DA Makes campaign, where they had great debates with all five or six candidates, including in prisons, by the way, with the inmates. It was really fabulous. But I mentioned to you some of the data last night. Half of the people polled in anticipation of this campaign thought that prosecutors had a minor or insignificant role in the criminal justice system. 40% of the respondents, I'm sorry, did not even know the DA was elected. The point, there's so far to go to bring the public along here. So public education is a huge part of this fix, ultimately, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, if my book accomplishes only one thing, and it's that people know they have the power to elect their local DA, I'll go away happy. Because we should think of the DA like the mayor, someone who is answerable to us, who has a tremendous influence over how our community feels, what it's like, how people experience the criminal justice system. And so just that piece of knowledge is really powerful.
How many of the, we discussed again last night, is it 12% of Americans live in a community where there's so-called the new kind of DA? So it's one out of eight, essentially, Americans. Do most prosecutors of virtually all are elected, I assume, around the country?
Yep, pretty much.
Do most of them run unopposed, or are they challenged?
Yes, most of them run unopposed, and most times they win, in part because they run unopposed. I'm going to throw out one more number for you. So because, you know, America has really big jurisdictions for electing prosecutors, big cities, counties like Suffolk County, where a lot of people live, if there were progressive prosecutors in the 125 biggest cities and metro areas, that would account for half of America's population. Wow. So, and that 125 is a manageable number. It's out of more than 2,400 elected prosecutors. But because so many of those people come from small rural counties, this 125 number, those are people with outsized influence. So you can see, again, why DA elections matter so much and how much potential there is for change here.
You know, can we change gears before we wrap this up? Because I just want to make sure you didn't have any more questions about the book.
No, I'm good.
Because we are the home of course, the New England Patriots, and Bob Kraft is the owner of the New England Patriots.
I've heard of the New England Patriots. My kids are big New England
they
Patriots.
They are? Yeah. Oh, you're a Connecticut kid where it's halfway
yes,
divided,
right? My husband grew up outside of Boston. I grew up in Philadelphia. I lost the football, all the sports arguments. I lost them all. So, yes, New England Patriots.
Anyway, we have been talking a lot about prostitution and sex trafficking after Bob Kraft was discovered at this massage parlor down in Florida. So you wrote a piece about sex workers and decriminalization. Give us your thesis about what should happen with prostitution.
Well, you know, I think that when you're talking about fully consensual sex work, that is, in my view, something that we have not shown is a good idea to make criminal. What ends up happening in that situation is that a lot of people who are often in difficult circumstances, a lot of women, end up in jail. You can talk about only prosecuting the clients, but the truth is, like, it's a business. And so if people are consensually doing this to make money and you take away their clients, then you're hurting their livelihood. That is a different conversation from people who are being coerced or forced into sex work, trafficking. You know, reading about the massage parlors in Florida, it sounded like there were women who were having, for example, their passports and visas taken away. They were not in fully consensual situations. That I find disturbing.
What's an example of, to use your words, a fully consensual sex worker or sex situation? Where's that happening?
I mean, it's happening all over the country. People find each other often online. People who want to sell a variety of services, of sexual services, they advertise them. And because of being able to advertise online, though I should say this is sort of threatened by now, by concern about this, but advertising online means you have a lot fewer people walking the streets, and walking the streets is much more dangerous.
You know, one last thing about this, because I've written a lot about this and thought a lot about this. One of the things that bothers me about the idea that I'm a fully consensual sex worker, I'm always suspicious, because no one wants their daughter to grow up to be a sex worker. I think, given a choice, you would not be doing this. So it's great to go after the Johns and not go after the women. On the other hand, part of me thinks that what we're doing is saying, okay, we're going to decriminalize what is essentially the abuse of women and the degradation of women, and that's my problem. Because I don't know how enthused you can really be about sex work several times a day with strangers.
So this is a serious divide among feminists and a difficult topic. I will say, you know, I interviewed sex workers all over the world when I was working on this story, 50 or more women. I do think there are people who choose this line of work. It's not what I would choose, but I also felt a lot of respect for them by the time I had spent a lot of time talking with them. People make a lot of different choices depending on their circumstances, and I think it's easy for me as a privileged person to be like, I don't want to do this. Judging other people for their choices, I kind of stopped doing that.
So I want to end on one other thing. You're a Philadelphia woman. I'm a Philadelphia man. I've spoken to you now 2 days. Where did the Philadelphia accent go? What happened?
So my parents aren't from Philadelphia, and I guess they just, like, I don't know. I was going to say beat it out of us, but that's wrong. They just discouraged it. Plus, I've been living in New England for so long. If I was still speaking with a Philadelphia accent, I'd be in big trouble by now.
Biggest smile we've gotten at Emily the whole time, saying no Philadelphia accent. Emily, your book is spectacular.
Yeah, congratulations. Thank you really very much for taking the time to come here. Much appreciated.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, a senior research fellow and lecturer at Yale Law School, and co-host of the Slate podcast, The Political Gabfest. Her latest book is Charged, a new movement to transform American prosecution and end mass incarceration. Up next, journalist and environmentalist Bill McKibben is here to talk about his latest book, Salted. He's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're on tape today, replaying some of our favorite discussions, which includes the one we had earlier this year with journalist and environmentalist Bill McKibben, who joined us to talk about his latest book. In 1989, Bill McKibben sounded the alarm on global warming with his book, The End of Nature. His warning wasn't so much the sky was falling, but that it was broiling. He warned us about the greenhouse effect and introduced us to the solemn reality. We were at a point where nature could no longer exist or persist uncontaminated by us. 30 years later, McKibben is still at it, and things are more dire than ever, which he makes clear in his latest book. It's called Falter. Has the human game begun to play itself out? Bill, it's great to see you, as always.
As always.
Well, it is great to see you. And I know we don't want to be too gloomy about the situation because we need to maintain some hope here so people can get energized. But you are basically talking about the human race not surviving.
Well, we're definitely talking about a world. I mean, look, when I wrote the first book about this 30 years ago, it was all in the nature of a distant threat, something we knew was coming. Scientists had given us a warning. We decided not to heed the warning, and so it came. In fact, it came faster and harder than anyone predicted. So now, I mean, look, everybody watched last fall in California, a city literally called Paradise literally turned into hell inside half an hour. There's a lot of TV cameras in California, but that kind of stuff goes on now someplace around the world every day. Right now in Mozambique, they're dealing with what they called the largest natural disaster in the history of the Southern Hemisphere, a cyclone that's flooded Mozambique, Malawi, Zimbabwe. People are dying of cholera in the aftermath. This is just our world now. It's going to get a lot worse unless we take the steps we can. And so that's why I wrote the book, in the hopes that we will take those steps.
We're going to return to the current book in a second. But, you know, last night I am looking at my bookshelf, such as it is, and I see my original copy of The End of Nature by Bill McKibben. And had I not fallen asleep on the couch, I was actually going to reread portions. But since I didn't get to it, Bill McKibben, what did you get right and what did you get wrong 30 years ago? And for those who don't know, this started this movement. I mean, it was the first, it's fair to say it was the first sort of popular book on the subject, was it not?
Yes, it's true. I wish that I'd gotten it all wrong, you know. I mean, I would have given anything to have been incorrect. Sadly, the only place that it's really incorrect is in how fast this was going to happen. We thought, scientists are by their nature conservative, as you know, we thought that the stuff we're seeing now, half the summer sea ice in the Arctic melted, the ocean 30% more acidic, we thought that was 2080, 2090, 2100 if we didn't do anything. We didn't know it was going to happen. We didn't know how finely balanced the Earth was, and that if you gave it the kind of shove we'd given it, you'd knock it entirely out of kilter.
You know, the new book, we're talking with Bill McKibben, the new book is Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? You also talk about two things that I hadn't even thought of in terms of where we're headed, climate change, is the role of genetic engineering and the role of artificial intelligence. Let's start with genetic engineering.
So these both fall into the category, Marjorie, of other things that represent kind of existential threats to our species. They're not as far advanced in a sense as climate change, though they're coming up pretty fast. I mean, it was 4 months ago that a Chinese doctor produced the first two designer babies on our planet. So far, the rest of the scientific community has pushed back against that some and seems to be trying to put in place some kind of safeguards, but it's a sign of how close we are.
It was to protect from HIV, theoretically. Is that what he's allegedly doing?
Theoretically, but as every other doctor pointed out, there's a million ways to keep from getting HIV that don't involve, A, the risky procedure that they performed, and B, more importantly, breaching this barrier that's all that stands between us and starting to view children as products. And when one talks about existential threat, that's really what I mean. In this case, a threat to the meaning of being human. I mean, you listen to these people, beginning with James Watson, the kind of father of the double helix, but on down through the people who want to do this kind of work, and they envision a world in which very quickly you're able to walk into a clinic and design your child to one extent or another, pay some money and get a different serotonin level or something. I mean, that's creepy in and of itself, but what's really creepy is to think what happens when you walk into the clinic 5 years later.
Yeah. And the science is advanced.
Science is advanced a little bit. Your next child, you've got a little more money, gets the better upgrade. What's your first child's Windows 6? You know?
I know, like your old iPhone.
So these are, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I tried to warn about the end of nature 30 years ago. We should be similarly concerned about the end of human nature. We take the stability of things for granted. We took the stability of the Earth for granted until it became very clear that that was not the case. And we take the stability of human meaning very much for granted, even though I think it's more fragile in the face of these new technologies than we might imagine.
You know, on the genetic and engineering front, Bill McKibben, I have to say, well, I surely didn't think it through as clearly and as thoroughly as you did. On the AI front, I apparently thought through it not at all, because whenever I thought of artificial intelligence and climate change or climate disruption, as Marjorie likes to call it, was it Naomi Wolf? Or who was the
not
one?
Not Naomi Wolf.
Naomi Klein. Klein, who first used the expression
yes, which I
climate
thought
disruption
was a great
with this.
Expression
yeah, it really says
because
I assume, without giving it a lot of thought, Bill McKibben, that artificial intelligence might ultimately be our ally in fighting climate disruption or climate change. You reach a different conclusion.
Well, depending on what you mean by it and how we use it, these advances can be useful. The thing that people are now very worried about, people like Stephen Hawking or whoever are warning us about, are what they call general artificial intelligence, an attempt to make machines that outthink human beings. And again, there's a million practical reasons to worry about this. I mean, putting people out of work, or as you saw in the Times over the weekend, the Chinese have now weaponized AI and facial recognition so that they can identify Uyghur Muslims mm-hmm. any place in the country in any crowd you want. I mean, that's a pretty bad science fiction movie right there. But remember Steve Wozniak, the guy who helped invent the
Steve Jobs,
the
buddy
Mac?
In the garage, right?
Exactly. He said at one point that, I mean, if you go very far down this path, the obvious result is that the machines are kind of keeping us around as pets.
Pets. Oh, my God.
In fact, he said he'd begun to feed his dog a steak just on kind of general principles. So we don't know as yet sort of where to draw the line. We're very clear where to draw the line on climate change. 350 parts per million CO2 is as much as we can have in the atmosphere. We're pretty clear where to draw the line, I think, on human genetic engineering, not crossing what they call the germ line, not making heritable modifications in people seems like a good idea. With AI, we don't know as much, but we should be paying attention to it the way we didn't pay attention to climate change 30 years back.
By the way, speaking of Naomi Klein, you corrected me, both of you, a minute ago. Naomi Klein said about Falter, Bill's latest book, Bill McKibben at his glorious best.
So I know you've been traveling a lot in the course of researching this book. Tell us some of the things that
I'll tell
we
you a good story
about.
Since we've been telling sad stories, let me tell you a really good one. The most encouraging trip I took was to Africa to Ghana, Ivory Coast, and then across to Tanzania. And I was in the most remote, rural, poor parts of those countries, places that not only don't have power now, but on current plans, we're never going to get it. No one is ever going to build the grid out to cover most of the close to a billion people who don't have access to electricity now. But the price of a solar panel has dropped so fast in the last decade that all of a sudden, just as with cell phones, people are leapfrogging the old technology and going to the new. And when you see it for the first time, when you see people getting power for the first time, you understand two things. One is what we take for granted. I mean, I was sitting in a circle of village elders in Ghana who had just gotten a new solar microgrid installed, okay? It's hot because it's on the equator and it's always hot, and they kept handing me plastic bottles of cold water to drink, for which I was grateful. But in my, you know, clueless suburban Boston way, it took me 15 minutes to figure out why they were so proud. I mean, until the week before when these solar panels had gotten there, there had never been anything cold in this place ever. Cold was, and that made me realize what an absolute miracle a solar panel is. I mean, you take a plate of glass, a sheet of glass, and you tilt it up at the sun, and out the back flows cold and light and information. I mean, that's Hogwarts scale magic, you know, and we should be, that's what we should be embracing now. If we have a chance in this fight against climate change, it would be the extremely rapid build out of sun and wind power around the world. It's cheap enough now. What we have to do is somehow overcome the vested interest of the fossil fuel industry that wants to extend its business model another few decades, even at the now obvious cost of breaking the planet in the process.
We're talking to Bill McKibben. You know, when he just mentioned, so I was, as I'm reading last night, I don't know why, when the solar panel obsession, in the best sense of the word, I thought of Dustin Hoffman saying one word, plastics.
Oh, yeah.
And all I could think of was you, two words, solar panels. Or, you know, when right after we got out of the Paris Climate Accord, you're both in op-eds you wrote and in conversations with us and people all around the country, Bill McKibben, your contention is that what was states, cities and towns, thoughtful businesses could fill the hole, as many of them have. But as the urgency gets greater and as the clock starts ticking faster, isn't the Trump factor such an obstacle that it's almost insurmountable? No matter how much everybody else does?
So it's a huge obstacle, and if he stays in power, perhaps insurmountable. The good news is that because of perhaps Trump to some degree, but also because of these disasters and because of the new science, there's arisen a new level of opposition that's really quite remarkable. So, for instance, today in the streets of London for the last 3 days, people have largely shut down the city with this group called Extinction Rebellion. You've noticed that around the world, following the example of the marvelous Greta Thunberg, the 15-year-old Swedish schoolgirl, there now are climate strikes weekly at schools that are taking millions of kids into the streets. You've watched as the veterans of the campus fossil fuel divestment movement have graduated from college and formed the groups that now formulated and are pushing the Green New Deal. We're seeing a new, we're in a climate moment, and it's the last of these moments that we're going to get in time to actually do anything. So we best seize it and seize it hard.
Before we take a quick break, do you know Thunberg? Have you met her?
Only over the phone. But
and what is she like in real? I mean, she is so wildly impressive on the screen.
She's fantastic. And as she has said at several occasions, one of the reasons that she's talked about this a lot, she's autistic. Mm-hmm. And she said, it allows me to focus on one thing and not be distracted. I don't mean to sound, too much like the Methodist Sunday school teacher here, but there's the Holy Spirit at work, in our world is pretty remarkable to see sometimes.
We're talking with Bill McKibben, environmentalist and journalist, about his new book, Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? We're going to keep talking to him on
8 Public Radio. We're continuing our conversation with Bill McKibben, who started it all with The End of Nature 30 years ago. He's continuing it. Well, he's had tons of books in between. The latest just out is called Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out?
You know, off the air, we were talking about how Greta Thunberg kind of reminds us of the activism of the gun kids who Parkland. Survived the Parkland massacre. Tell us about when she was over at the gathering of all the billionaires over there.
In Davos, Switzerland. Yes, she looked around on this crowd of, you know, people who'd all flown in on their private jets while she'd taken the train from Sweden. And she said, you guys won't even describe the problem accurately. You won't even admit the level of the crisis. You make children do that for you. I mean, her original stand, you know, when she stopped, I mean, she basically said when she stopped going to school last fall, she said, if the government can't be bothered to prepare our world for the future to try and head off this great crisis, it's a little rich to ask me to spend all my time in school preparing for the future, you know. What about we strike some kind of bargain here? And now it's a request/demand that, I mean, I got to tell you, when we had school strikes spread to the U.S. last month, I wrote a op-ed piece together with a 12-year-old in Colorado, Haven Coleman, for the L.A. Times. And it was great fun to be working with someone literally a fifth my age, you know. And it gives me, I mean, part of my thing over, you know, was that for many years, it wasn't even like anybody even wrote another book about climate change. You remember Ross Gelbspan? Mm-hmm. He was the next person sort of 5 years after The End of Nature to write a serious book about this. There were years when I felt like one of those people in you ever have one of those nightmares where you're trying to, there's like some monster and you're trying to alert people, but nobody can hear or your voice can't come out.
You're shouting. Or
that's what I felt like. Don't feel like that anymore. There's a big movement out there, and it's going to be heard. The question is simply, can we make this transition happen fast enough? We know we're going to make the transition. 50 years from now, the world's going to run on sun and wind because sun and wind are free, and even Exxon can't hold that back forever. But if it takes us 50 years, then the world we run on sun and wind will be a broken world. If we can make it happen faster, we can head off some of the worst.
So we know that for the most part, there's not a sense of urgency in Washington. Obviously, the new kids and the Green New Deal, about which you've spoken a bit, we can talk about that in a minute. And we know about the lack of urgency there. We get a sense, obviously, in virtually every page, in the your sense of urgency and Falter. What's your realistic assessment of where the American people are? You know, we naively, years ago, Marjorie and I on the radio, like everybody else on the radio and TV, said 20 dead kids in Connecticut is going to change everything. Obviously, it didn't. Well, we watched the fires, and we're practically the whole state burnt down last year. It was the lead story on every news, and we say to each other, well, that is going to be the tangible evidence
and
that's going to change everything.
Has anything changed everything?
I don't mean to sound too partisan, but in both these cases, you know, the American public opinion has shifted dramatically in the right direction. But the Republican Party is a dead weight against, I mean, the U.S. Senate is just where every good idea goes to die. The good news is that I think that finally the political currents really are shifting. you'll remember that for the last three presidential cycles, what environmentalists did was beg, completely unsuccessfully, to have someone ask a question about climate change at one of the presidential debates. Never happened. Okay, not going to be a problem this time around. Everybody in the Democratic field is talking strongly about this. Some, Bernie, Senator Warren, Jay Inslee, talking really strongly. Senator Warren had a proposal yesterday about public lands in this mm-hmm. country, saying we're not going to use them anymore for drilling and mining. Those days will be over, which would be a huge shift. Bernie's climate plan out yesterday in full-fledged form, you know, as remarkable as one would expect. Some one of these people is going to win the nomination, and then this is going to be one of the issues that they try to ram down the throat of the incumbent, because he is miles away. I mean, his contention that climate change is a hoax manufactured by the Chinese. I mean, look, if you sat next to somebody on an, you know, MBTA bus who was muttering about climate change being a hoax manufactured by the Chinese, you get up and change seats, you know. He's miles out of step with American public opinion on this. He's the opinion that he's in step with is the Koch brothers' opinion. I mean, that's why we don't get anything done. But sooner or later, this logjam's going to break. The question is entirely sooner or later.
You know, talk about the rapid change, too, even though I'm not nearly as hopeful, I guess, as you are. I want to be. It was just, what, 2.5 years ago that your fellow home stater, Bernie Sanders, was talking at some debate about the greatest national security threat being climate change and being ridiculed for it. I don't think he'd be ridiculed for it in 2019, except maybe by Donald Trump.
My guess is even Donald Trump's going to try and stay away from this question if he can, but I don't think anyone's going to let him. Yes, the public mood has shifted and shifted dramatically. And eventually that will tell. Our problem, of course, is that, and this is the one thing always to remember, climate change is the first timed test that we have faced as a civilization. Mm. I mean, you know, Dr. King would always say, quoting the Massachusetts abolitionist Theodore Parker, he'd always say, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. This may take a while, but we're going to win. The arc of the physical universe, by contrast, is short and bends toward heat. If we don't win soon, we don't win.
Yeah,
that's why I get depressed sometimes.
You're talking about, and others are talking about, you know, 10 to 20 years for a complete elimination of the fossil fuel industry for us to...
So this is the place where I have to restrain myself from saying, oh, if only you'd listen to me when, you know, because 30 years ago, there actually were tons of things we could have done that were relatively easy. In 1989, a modest price on carbon would have been more than enough to steer us in a new direction. You know, our trajectory would have shifted, and with ours, China's, and so on. We wouldn't have solved climate change by this point because it's an enormous problem, but we'd be well on the way. Instead, having let the fossil fuel industry trap us in a completely sterile debate for 30 years about whether or not global warming was real, a debate, remember, that both sides knew the answer to at the beginning, just one of them was willing to lie about it, having wasted those 30 years, now all our options are
bad,
are pretty bad. We have to move more quickly than is politically, socially, economically comfortable.
By the way, people should read the L.A. Times. That's where those stories broke about what they knew and didn't tell us.
And Inside Climate News.
You know, we only have a minute left, and this may be as naive as I fear it is. If clean energy is inevitable, it's either ruin or clean energy, and the fossil fuel companies could decide tomorrow, we're going to own that industry and profit just as much as we profit now.
Well,
why don't they just buy it and do it?
They're starting to do a little of that, but the answer to your question is contained within it. The phrase profit just as much as they do now. That's the rub. So if you're Exxon, the thing you don't like about solar energy is once you put the panels up on the roof, the sun comes for free. If your business model is getting everybody to write a check every month for a new delivery, that just strikes you as the dumbest business model anyone ever thought up. For the rest of us, it's terrific. And it's a reminder that if we take this step, it'll not only keep us from overheating more than we have to, it'll also lead to a more democratic, more local, more egalitarian society. We shall see.
Bill McKibben is an environmentalist and journalist. He's the Schumann Distinguished Scholar at Middlebury College and leader of the anti-carbon campaign group 350.org. Before we go, we're thinking of the fragility of nature, and we're going to play for you an acrostic written by Nancy McCarthy, one of the acrostic contest winners. Here's Richard Blanco reading it.
By Nancy McCarthy. Right to farm community. Ignore the rocks big as your barn. Eden, east of Providence, hives of honey and howling coyotes, owls' oration fills the dusk, black ponds of bog iron, oak and cedar lurching in swamps, thick with brambles, habitat for the endangered. Hold on to this.
That's a great one. I love that.
That's a nice, right? Like, such beautiful rendered images of nature. And that last line really is sort of is what gives you that punch and makes it like this poem. It's like, you know, hold on to this. It's kind of like, you're not, you know, it's, as we know, it brings up an ecology, a climate warming issue in the poem in between the lines by that line. So the nice one.
Up next, MIT economists Jonathan Gruber and Simon Johnson are here to talk about their new book. Stick around for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of our favorite conversations, and that includes the one we had with MIT economists Jonathan Gruber and Simon Johnson about their new book. It's called Jump Starting America.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're broadcasting from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. In a new book, MIT economists Jonathan Gruber and Simon Johnson offer a solution to our broken economy, where growth is only happening in a handful of cities that are already thriving. It's put a renewed emphasis on investing in research and development, just as the government did after World War II. It's called Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. John Gruber is the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT and a key architect of both RomneyCare and Obamacare. Simon Johnson is the Kurtz Professor of Entrepreneurship at MIT and a former chief economist of the IM. Simon, great to meet you. John, great to see you.
Jim, I got in trouble with one story. So I told my parents that I was writing the book with Simon Johnson. Like, ooh, he's really famous.
There you go. Well, we'll start with Simon, the really famous. You know, I take some tiny solace because no one can afford to live here anymore in Boston, that at least we're a superstar city for the huge rents going through the roof. But Jumpstarting America is the name of your book. So how do we jumpstart America?
Well, first of all, Marjorie, we build on the success, the kind of success we've seen in Boston and in Cambridge. Invest in science, turn that science into jobs, good jobs, right? These are very good jobs, but also spread that around the country because exactly as you said, the coastal superstar cities have become extremely expensive. But there's a tremendous amount of talent spread across the U.S. We identify 102 potential new next-generation tech hubs, we call them. And that's not maybe the exhaustive or exclusive list. People should look at our website, develop their own criteria, and let's have this argument and discussion, but spread this same recent Boston-type model much more broadly.
What do those 102 communities have? What are the common threads that make them eligible to become the next tech hubs, or at least hubettes, or whatever you want to call them?
Hubettes, I like that
term.
Talent is obviously very important. You need to have people, you need to have young people, they need to have the right kind of education. Good living conditions also matter, right? People want to live in a place, good climate, a much better commute time, for example, than you have in the mega cities, and low crime rate. Those are our very simple, transparent criteria, but we're open to other suggestions, and we're particularly open to all these great ideas we're getting about technology pockets that have developed around particular places. I was having a great conversation about Milwaukee, for example, yesterday, and some of the things they're really good at in Milwaukee.
So beer, I think, is one of the things they're particularly
Yes, that did come up.
So, Jonathan, you start this book, well, you both started this book together, with talking about a guy that I'm embarrassed to say I never heard of, Vannevar Bush, who was the head of the U.S. World War II scientific effort. But you begin with this unbelievably hopeful, encouraging chapter about what the United States, which can't seem to do anything anymore, managed to do beginning in World War II and continuing on. Tell us.
You know, so much of the fun part of doing this book was actually relearning the history. And one of the most understated episodes in our history came in June 1940. You have to remember, before that point, we thought that Germany wasn't really up to much. And we knew they were dangerous, but we didn't realize the technology they had. They then blitzed across Europe in stunning fashion, introducing new technologies we didn't even know existed or they had. Meanwhile, the U.S. had made a total of 6 tanks in 1939. Our soldiers were training with brooms rather than guns. We were totally behind. Vannevar Bush went to FDR and he said, look, I'm not a military guy. I'm a guy from the Carnegie Institute for Science. I want you to endow me with the power to convene the nation's scientists and unlimited budget, develop technologies that will win the war. Fast forward, he did it. He developed radar. He developed bombs that worked, guns that worked. Basically, a lot of why we won World War II was because of that meeting in the Oval Office and because Vannevar Bush had the vision to set up an institution that at one point employed 2/3 of all physicists in America and basically developed the technology that won the war.
But this continued after the war and created what I recall as a little girl is this wonderful halcyon time. I mean, I'm a white person, so it wasn't halcyon if you were other people, but that one dad could pay for, you know, the kids and the little vacation and stuff. This boom. So what continued that made that difference in terms of the government scientific partnership?
I think the really important point about scientific partnership, and the key word is partnership, is the government makes these investments in fundamental science with a lot of spillover effects. The private sector doesn't want to do that anywhere near as much because you can't capture the individual profits. But once you've got the basic science, once you've got the knowledge, once you've built radar in World War II, an entire industry or set of industries, commercial aviation, microelectronics, can be built on the basis of that same knowledge. And it's those industries that created the good jobs that your dad worked in, that my family took advantage of back in the UK. That's what gave us the long post-war boom, and that's what we started to lose as we drifted away from that model in the 1960s and 1970s.
Well, what we also had was a common cause. I mean, there's nothing better than a war, to use a horrible notion, to unite people. Maybe the only thing that's close is having a good-looking, young, charismatic president saying we've got to get to the moon as quickly as possible. Those are pretty critical elements of this whole mix, are they not, Simon?
Yes, of course. 1956 Sputnik, which wasn't a war, but it wasn't a hot war, it was the Cold War. The Russians put the first satellite, it scared us, and it gave us a common moment, and there was no real disagreement in Congress. We have to respond, and we should respond, I would say not in a knee-jerk way, this was the view at the time, we respond with technology, we respond with investment. We built from that the world's leading satellite industry, not just in the late 50s, early 60s, but today. We have the lion's share of the good jobs in satellite, everything to do with satellites around the world in the United States. Why? Because we were first to develop that industry for military, geopolitical purposes, yes, but we turned that into an economic windfall.
How much does being first matter in any of these kinds of things, John?
Being first matters a lot.
Why?
And actually, being first matters a lot because you set the standards. So, for example, look at cell phone technology, 1G, 2G, 3G. Mm. Basically, that started Finland. Actually made their modern economy by dominating development of 2G. Then 3G.
That's why they're the happiest people on earth.
That's why
they're
the happiest people on earth. Then 3G went to Japan, and they made a boom out of that. 4G was more U.S. dominated. Now we're fighting with China over 5G. Whoever develops these technologies first sets the standards, gets the basic conditions down. There is so many fixed costs in developing these technologies, that basically, if you do it first, you then become the leader.
So
and create
are we
the jobs
too late to be first on the ideas you two are proposing in jumpstarting America?
No. In fact, what we do is we talk in the book about several areas of technology which have a common feature. First of all, they were invented here based on government research. Second of all, we led in them. Third of all, we're falling behind, but we're not too far behind yet.
What are a couple examples?
So a great example is synthetic biology. This is basically developing the laboratory. Natural processes. So, for example, the drug to treat malaria came from a plant that was found in China that was in shortage and could lead to huge spikes in the price of the malaria-treating drug. We developed a synthetic version of that that's saving millions of lives. We invented this industry, largely at MIT. We dominated the industry. Now, suddenly, the NSF stopped funding it. China has now developed a whole set of research centers to this industry. They're taking over. So we had a competition that we set up in the U.S. where the U.S. used to win every year. Now we're not winning anymore. So it's not too late, but we're losing that lead. We need to get back in the lead.
We're talking with Jonathan Gruber and Simon Johnson. The book is Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. Why can't the common cause, I mean, it's probably not going to happen with President Trump, who doesn't really recognize income inequality, and the economy is doing well for, as you guys point out, for people that are already doing well. But why can't the common cause be what you guys talk about, the fact that these huge, wonderful things are happening in these little super cities. Not much is happening everywhere else. There is huge income inequality. Kind of what the Democrats are talking about, getting back that American dream. Well, can't that work?
Yes, it could work, but I'm pushing for the common cause, honestly, because we need growth. We need productivity. Everyone across the political spectrum recognizes that. The question is, how do you get it? And the answer is not just the private sector or just the government. It's the partnership, the key word that you used earlier. We need government strategic investments, develop the basic science, recognize there's a lot of spillover effects, and we need to make it easier for private businesses to build on that and spread that around the country. It's not that difficult. It's really, I know growth seems hard. I know we're very worked up about the long-term slowdown in growth in the United States, but we can really turn that around. Common cause would be the way to do it.
Well, there's also another. I'm sorry, the GDP growth was like 4%, was it not? During this time, there was more of a common cause, and we're not anywhere near that now.
We're projected in the 2020s to be at less than half of that.
Yeah.
And the key thing is to come back to the boring economics, which is what causes growth. What causes growth is productivity, how much we produce per hour we work. And what increases productivity? It's invention and innovation. And real innovation isn't done by any one private company. Because a private company is interested in their bottom line, and they do innovative things. But the real innovation comes from things like one of our favorite examples in the book, the Human Genome Project. So let's talk about that for a minute. So in 1975, two scientists won the Nobel Prize for discovering how to sequence DNA, how to understand how those little letters in the DNA line up to determine our genetic destiny. Fast forward to the
late 19th. That's the one where they left the woman out. Isn't that the one? Is that the one?
Yeah. I don't know. So then fast forward to 1988, one of those scientists who'd actually discovered this sequence and had already started one successful company wanted to start a company to sequence the entire human genome, to map the whole human body. No private sector company would invest because they're like, what's in it for us? Once you make this map, it's public. We're not going to put the money in. The government did it, created something called the Human Genome Project, put $3 billion in over 13 years. The result today is an industry which is dominated by the U.S., has generated $1 trillion in economic value, and today has almost 300,000 jobs with an average salary of $70,000 a year, all because government put in the science money.
We're talking to John Gruber and Simon Johnson. Their book is Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. You know, I had a choice the other night. It was two nights ago. I'm sitting at home. I can either watch the second episode of Veep, which is one of my favorite shows, or I can watch the two of you on some MIT Sloan in-house TV thing. And incredibly, I did not watch Veep. But then, wow. Simon, I hear you say in the middle of this thing, and I almost fell off my chair, something like, hey, everybody in America supports science. And then I said to myself, with one exception, let's hear from him.
I'm not denying climate change, but it could very well go back. You'd have to show me the scientists because they have a very big political agenda.
If you have a windmill anywhere near your house, congratulations. Your house just went down 75% in value. And they say the noise causes cancer.
Well, you know, I said that with a smile on my face, but it is a serious thing. When you guys are pitching science as the thing that's going to take us down the yellow brick road or get us to salvation or to serious economic growth, when you have a president who is, I mean, it is factually true, is an anti-science leader, how do you get around that political obstacle, which is huge?
Well, I would say, fortunately, this is not a country run by one person exclusively. Members of Congress on both sides of the aisle are very open to the kind of conversation that we're proposing. Now, it is a little bit behind closed doors, I agree. Getting people to come out in public is a little bit of a chicken and egg. I don't want to do it until you do it sort of thing. But we are absolutely convinced that this is a compelling agenda. There's big rates of return from science. The National Institutes of Health does actually have public bipartisan support. We think that can be spread much more broadly across the scientific frontier.
Also, it seems to me if there's most people think, I'll try to be as kind as I can be, that Donald Trump's anti-science bent is either based on stupidity, as Janet Yellen described his understanding of economics, or a political agenda. Maybe this is naive, but it seems to me if somebody he trusted could convince him that if you want the GDP at the number that you promised that we're not at, the thing that can get you from here to there is investment in the thing you say you don't believe in, science. So if it helps him, it might be something that he'd buy into. Is that?
And this is, I think, a key lesson we learned from history, is that the scientists were great at doing the science and being excited about the process of science. What they got wrong was recognizing that science is growth policy. And that's a key highlight of the book, that science...
Wrong meaning they didn't pitch it as growth policy?
They didn't pitch it.
They didn't
because they had the war to turn to. They had the Cold War. The way we get science adopted now is recognizing that science makes jobs. The rate of return to these investments is enormous. We have examples. We have data in the book. You can look at it. And basically, what we need to do is now not just recognize science for discovery, but science for growth.
But I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're not proposing a big tax hike. You're just proposing a reallocation of federal money higher toward research and development and science, and it has been not this massive. This isn't going to mean you're going to be doubling your taxes.
No, absolutely not. We're recommending a big investment in science, in R&D, and we're saying that you get the returns back either to the government in forms of taxes, or we propose an innovation dividend, so actually give cash back to the American people. On the Human Genome Project case that John just mentioned, it was a $3 billion investment by the government. That industry now pays at least $6 billion per year in taxes. Where else can you get that kind of rate of return?
What's the innovation dividend there, Simon? What would that mean?
So the idea of the innovation dividend is find ways to capture the upside. For example, the appreciation of the real estate you get in these new hubs. Put that into an innovation fund. Alaska does this with oil revenues. Mm. Do it with tech upside and give cash to all Americans, $500, $1,000, $2,000 per year. It's not a lot of money to some people, but to others, it's very effective in terms of pulling them out of poverty and giving them real buy-in for this approach.
Well, speaking of buy-in, I don't want to obsess on the politics, but just one more minute on this. Your first answer to Marjorie, Simon, is also part of the political solution, is when it's not just Boston and L.A. and New York and all the places that don't vote with a particular party, but some of 102 communities spread across the country, the buy-in, the pressure from Republican and Democratic legislators, obviously, who could benefit, becomes immense. So there's a political strategy connected to your formula here, too.
There absolutely is. And the thing to remember, at the local level, red and blue is way below jobs.
Yeah,
so we talked to the CEO of a major company that shopped themselves around America, like not Amazon, but another one. And they said if he was blindfolded, he couldn't tell if he was talking to a Democrat or Republican. They all want jobs. So the way we think to build the political will for this is from the bottom up, to recognize local level, to recognize that red or blue, we all want to be a place that in 5 years from now, when the next big company has their competition where to locate, they seriously consider my house.
Can I ask you one more question about this, and then we want to ask you about a related thing, if we can. Who are the members of Congress, who's a name that we might know, who are science obsessed, who either bought into this notion that you're advancing or didn't even need you to explain to the larger population? Are there science geeks in Congress whose names might...
There are a lot of NIH geeks. There are a lot of the NIH geeks. There are a lot of people who believe in funding medical research. I think a name that intrigues me right now is Lamar Alexander, Republican
Tennessee,
really? Who, in reacting to the Green New Deal,
said,
I don't like a lot of it, but I like the research piece.
Yeah.
Huh.
So it's striking. There's a perfect example of someone from the opposite side of the aisle from typical spending proposals saying, I like this research idea. I think what Simon said is exactly right. There's a lot of people behind closed doors who like this, and the question is, can this finally be that elusive bipartisan feature that lets people hold hands and jump together?
Senator Richard Shelby, who I believe is the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, is very committed to research and development in Alabama. Huntsville is a big success story. We talk about that historically in our book.
Well, Huntsville is also, isn't that where the rockets were made? The Apollo that's in the Doug Brinkley's new book, too, American Moonshot.
Yes.
One thing before you move on to your next question. You guys are both hotshot economists here. I know nothing about the economy, but just reading what I've read of your book and everything I've read about it, it seems like a fairly obvious idea that research and development with a partnership would yield great results. So I guess why did we stop? Was this Ronald Reagan saying government is the enemy, or what?
I mean, there's really it's a great question. So we peaked in the mid-1960s with one in every $50 in America being public R&D. We led the world by far. Today we're 0.7%, or close to 10th in the world. What happened? Really, three things. First of all, the scientists didn't pay enough attention to the implications of what they were doing. They were worried about developing things like a nuclear-powered pen and not worried enough about nuclear radiation. The second is that once you lost those common goals, scientists and politicians started disagreeing about things like supersonic aircraft, anti-ballistic missiles. And as we say in the book, if you speak truth to power, power might cut your funding. And then the third thing is that budgets got tight. It was the Reagan anti-tax revolution. And remember, the way the American budget, we've talked about budgeting a lot on this show, the way it's set up is we have mandatory programs like Social Security and Medicare. They just grow naturally. The rest of the budget that gets squeezed is the discretionary part of the budget.
Yeah.
Even under President Obama, all those battles we had about the debt ceiling, that was all about squeezing the discretionary part of the budget. So even under Obama, post the Great Recession, R&D funding fell a lot.
You know, I, on a related notion, where obviously science is the core, Marjorie, I wanted to talk about healthcare just for a minute and the impact on the economy of the debate we're going to see. My experience has always been, I'll do the same disclaimer, I'm not an economist either.
No, we're not.
Is a certainty is what businesses like almost more than the underlying policies. They know that it's going to be a predictable kind of thing. When the likely Democratic candidate is going to be talking about Medicare for all, Medicare for America, some other than just fixing the Affordable Care Act, which obviously you were involved in putting together, Jonathan, what's the impact of just that debate? I mean, for example, if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, he's a guy who believes not only should we have Medicare for all, we shouldn't have any private insurance at all. What's the impact of the debate itself, assuming that one of those Democrats is the person running against Donald Trump, on the economy and the uncertainty that it might create?
I mean, that's a great question. So let me tie it back into the theme we've been discussing. If you want to do Medicare for all or any comprehensive health insurance, you've got to recognize we've got a long-run fiscal crisis on our hands with healthcare costs. As I mentioned before, if you project over the full long run, the U.S. is $70 trillion in deficit, more than $60 trillion of which is healthcare. What's the problem? The problem is that every other sector of the economy, new technologies drive costs down. In healthcare, new technologies drive costs up. Why? Because the private agents developing those technologies want things that's going to increase their profits. If the public sector can partner with the private sector, say, hey, we're going to help fund your research into technologies that can improve health while lowering costs, then that's how we can address our long-run fiscal problem. But the private sector is not going to do that on their own. Their interest isn't in lowering costs. It's that we're going to need public sector partnership with the private sector to actually invent new technologies that can make it affordable to get everyone health insurance in the long run. So I think it ties very much into what we're saying in this book.
Do you want to ask about the Fed before we go?
Yeah, we can do that. And Simon, I broached this with John Gruber last night. There's been a lot of criticism of the two likely choices of Donald Trump, Herman 999 Kane, and Stephen Moore, who apparently doesn't think child support matters and that sort of thing, even though, but that doesn't have to do with maybe, well, I don't know if it's an economic
issue.
Is
one or both the gold standard person, too, aren't they? Isn't
that one of them? At least one of them is. Oh, yeah. Both of them are?
They have been in the past, yeah.
Putting them aside, it's fine if you want to comment on them. The underlying thing that I asked John about last night, but I'd love to get your two cents, is there a lot of people who can't stand Moore or Kane and also aren't so crazy about Trump who have told me that he's right on this interest rate issue with the feds, that they should be cutting rates, or at least they should not be increasing rates like they had been. I know they've paused now. Who's right in this interest rate thing, which obviously sounds arcane, but trickles down to almost everything we all touch? Who's right on this?
I think that's a really, really difficult question to answer, because the economy is running fairly hot. We're close to full employment. Typically, you'd expect to see some signs of inflation, and you'd want to get ahead of it with interest rate increases. We're not seeing those signs of inflation right now. Okay, so let's be clear. However, I think the bigger point to look at in the Kane-Moore combination is that these people who said for a long time that they're supply-side people, this is the big Republican message, we're going to cut taxes, cut regulation, it's not working. The Trump tax cuts have not moved the needle in terms of expected growth, even in the White House's own forecast. So what are they doing? They're putting these so-called supply-side people into the Fed to try and massage the demand side, goose the economy, ahead of the election. Well, I don't really think that's going to end that well. However, they are speaking to the same frustration that we're trying to address in this book, which is we want more growth. They want more growth. We want more good jobs. That's what everybody wants. what we're proposing here is a better, more viable, and more sustainable way to get
there. By the way, your skill, both of you, to turn any question into something about the book is really masterful.
Why not?
It's very nice.
Can we put that on the back of the next
book? I'm afraid you can't. For a fee, you could. But no, good to see you both.
Okay.
Thank you both.
Thanks, guys.
Looks great.
Congratulations.
Really, congratulations.
Thanks for having us.
We non-economists actually can understand it.
So we can. It's shocking.
And I can't believe you chose over Veep. That's really impressive.
Jonathan Gruber is the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT. He was instrumental in creating both the Massachusetts healthcare reform and the Affordable Care Act. Simon Johnson is the Kirst Professor of Entrepreneurship at MIT and the former chief economist at the IMF. Their new book is Jumpstarting America: How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. Up next, Michael Norton is here for another in-depth look at human behavior. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of our favorite discussions, and we pick things up with Harvard Business School's Michael Norton. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 for our monthly exploration of human behavior. We'd look at why we do the things we do as behavioral economist Michael Norton. Today we're looking at how oversimplifying things we do when we care for our friends and family can backfire, such as, microwaving frozen food for the family dinner rather than making a homemade meal. Or instead of helping our elderly parents with housekeeping, we hire a cleaning service instead. Or how about this? Instead of helping our kids prepare for the SATs, we take a shortcut and bribe someone in college admission with $500,000. I thought that was a good one. I hope that's right. In any case, Michael Norton is the Harold M. Brearley Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. His latest book is Happy Money: The Science of Happier Spending. Hello, Michael. Nice to see you.
How are you? Just want to start by saying I'm strongly pro-bribe.
You are.
Just to get that on the record so everybody knows where I stand.
We'll take that into consideration, Michael. You know what I love is this anecdote about cake mix, that the cake mix people figured out that if they needed to add the fresh egg yourself in order to make it feel like you were participating in the making of the cake in the cake mix. That makes total sense to me.
That's the marketing geniuses when instant food started being in the 50s. You know, it was the space age, like the Jetsons with the pre-made food.
TV dinners.
And people started to feel like they weren't really caring for their family because it was too easy. So if you look at a lot of those meals, they added just like one step. And then you feel like, you know, you've done enough that it shows that you care about your family.
Exactly.
Okay, so let me be clear about what your research says. Is that, and by the way, in about a handful of minutes after Michael explains it to us, we're going to take your phone calls at 877-301-8970, see if this resonates with you, it describes you. I believe first that there has been research on how the recipient of your care, your friends, your family, your parents, your whatever, feel when you don't put much effort in taking care of them or giving them something. That kind of research has been done. Am I right about that?
Yes, although the results are a little nuanced, so we can
chat discuss
about
that too.
Yeah, yeah.
But your primary focus is on the caregiver or the provider itself. How is their view of themselves affected by how much they oversimplify or simplify the effort to provide care, whether it's a meal or sitting with a sick relative? Is that a fair big picture description of what you did?
Yeah, it's parents with their kids, it's partners with their partners, it's sick family members, how we care for them.
Okay.
We want to feel that we did something to show somehow that we care for them.
And we think less of ourselves, and you'll fill in the blanks in a minute, when we do take a shortcut, when we hire someone, as I just said, to do the cleaning rather than cleaning their house themselves, or a frozen dinner, which may taste fabulous, but we didn't go through the torture of making it ourselves. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the tension, is that we may feel guilty that we didn't, you know, bake a homemade casserole for our, you know, sick friend. Our friend who gets our homemade casserole, that might be disgusting, right? Maybe they would have wanted us to go to, you know, Chick-fil-A, whatever, and get something from there. But it's so, we're almost, even though we're trying to show that we care about them, we're almost focusing on our own feelings about whether we're a caring person, and a little bit less about, is this something that the person on the other end actually wants and needs?
So tell us a little bit what you did.
So we tried, one of the examples that we used was the snoo. SNOO, which is this crib. It's like a space age crib for infants that it does many things according to the thing. But one of the things it does is it senses when the baby is stirring, and it will automatically rock the baby.
I love it.
At the appropriate artificial intelligence level of rockingness, I guess. I'm not sure what it is, so that the baby is soothed. So my,
so you can stay asleep, essentially, exactly. Is what it is.
So
okay.
My student, Jimena Garcia Rada, her idea, this project was her idea, and she found the snoo. She looked online to see what people say about people who buy the snoo. Okay, so it's not, at first it's not how I feel if I bought one and put my kid in it, but it's what we think of people who can't be bothered to get out of bed and take care of their own child, but would rather put it in a, you know, computer thing or whatever and let it. And people, of course, are furious. You know, what kind of a parent would do that? You're so lazy. You obviously don't care about your kid. Why don't you just suck it up like the rest of us? So there's this real feeling around taking the easy way out with kids and with people we care about. And that's exactly what we wanted to study is what's going on there. Because the snoo, for all I know, might be better for the kid. I mean, I don't know. Who knows how to rock the kid?
Exactly.
Maybe it does. But we seem to care less about whether it actually works well and what it says about us if we're the kind of person who uses it.
So when you looked at that, what does it say about us to us?
People tend to think in all sorts of scenarios, which could be, you know, picking somebody up at the airport. Do you send a car for them or do you go and pick them up
yourself? That's a good one, actually.
Somebody's in the hospital. Do you make them something from scratch or do you pick up something in the gift shop? All of these sorts of situations, we find that people seem to really feel that if they take the easy way out, that they will not feel good about what they've done and the person on the other end will not feel cared for. And sometimes that can be true, but it's definitely not always true. Sometimes it would be perfectly fine to, you know, get someone a pre-made meal if it was really the best thing for them. But we seem to feel this real barrier.
I think this is so true. I think it's so true. You know, we've all got children here. You know, I never had the snoo because that's my kids are old now. But we all have
those
rocking
cardboard boxes.
Well, they had those rocking swings, so you could put the kid in the rocking swing while you're having dinner, or whatever. And the kid's going back and forth, not in the house now. Boom, 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 back and forth.
Battery operated, right?
In this swing. You kind of think if it stopped short, the kid would go flying out and be repelled 50 feet across the room. But it got you through dinner, or you know. So I love those rocking swings.
But I want to get back to what you said a minute ago. Is our feeling of less self-worth when we take the easy road, for lack of a better expression, is unrelated to how the act is received by the person for whom we're doing it? Is that what you're saying? Is that it's all about how we view ourselves, not how the recipient of our behavior views us. Is that where you're going?
In this research, we focus mainly on how you feel when you put your kid in the crazy swingy thing. Mm-hmm. You know, do you feel like a good parent anymore or not? But across lots of research, you can find sometimes it is very nice to make something homemade for someone. Of course, you bring it to the hospital and it's, you know, it smells great. But people seem to think that they should always do that, even if they don't know how to bake or something like that, right? So it's not that someone can't feel amazingly cared for if you make them something from scratch. They definitely can. But givers seem to be applying it in all sorts of crazy ways and thinking all kinds of crazy things that the recipient really isn't thinking at all.
You know, go ahead, I'm sorry.
And you talk about handmade gifts too, like that's a big deal. And what does that mean, a handmade gift?
Another great example is people have a wedding registry and then they have a friend who's like an artist. And the artist is like, well, I decided not to get you, you know, the pots and pans you wanted. I painted you a 30-foot mural, you know, of something or other. And I thought you could put it on your, you know, your living room wall or something. It's handmade. It showed a lot of effort, a lot of caring. Not really what the couple wanted. They actually needed, like, a saucepan.
Oh, God, that's a great one, the registry. Because you do feel a little like you're taking the easy way out just to go to the wedding registry.
Even though they've given you permission by creating the registry.
But on the other hand, that's what they want.
So do you have a
I
good
know
example?
People that will do, not the 30-foot mural, but they'll do some ridiculous gift because they don't want to be bothered with that wedding registry,
right.
You know, and they buy something stupid.
So does his research describe you? It totally describes me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
do you have an example? Because I have one.
Well, just yesterday I had some friends over, family for Sunday dinner, and they were bringing, because several of them are vegan, they were bringing their own vegan
lasagna, so I bought these vegan cakes. And I was going to get some lasagna that you got me from that place you like in Somerville. Yeah. But I thought, gee, I got to make something here. So I made my own lasagna and my own roasted vegetables because I felt otherwise I'd be giving them like all the store-bought
food. But why
food.
Why is that? I mean, I think I'd be the exact same way. I got to make something, even if to, I'll give you a good one. My kid, one of my younger kid who's in her 20s, so she's not a little girl, just went to South Korea to visit a friend for a week. And her plane was really early, and we had this back and forth of whether she should take a lift or I should drive her. And believe me, she had no desire to see me at 4:30 in the morning. So clearly her preference was, I'll take a lift, and I don't have to talk to anybody. I'll get up, whatever. And we went back and forth for days because I felt so horrible that I couldn't, that I took the effort-free route. I paid for the lift, by the way. Mm-hmm. Even though she preferred the effort-free route because it made her happier. And I not only did I feel horrible leading up to it, I felt horrible for a day after.
She already
got on the plane. And I obviously still do, and it's 3 days in because I took the easy route, even though the product of taking the easy route was not only acceptable to her, was preferable to her because it wasn't preferable to me.
I'm going to make you feel really bad now.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. My father died when I was in my 20s, so I was pretty young. And I remember I was flying back to college in California, and I was going to come up to Boston and party with my friends. So he said, I'll bring you to the airport. I said, no, don't forget it, Dax. I'm going to go up and party with so-and-so.
Oh, don't tell. This story is horrible.
I'll never forget.
So I can't believe you're
telling this. My father, even though I was already up in Boston partying, drove from Cape Cod up from Fall River, actually. I was living from Fall River up to Boston to see me off at the airport. And I'll never forget
Well, you're trying to make me feel bad. Can I tell you what I'm doing?
As I live.
I wasn't going to say this because it sounds like it's full of myself. I am driving to South Korea at the end of the week to pick her up in Seoul and drive her back. Because I felt
a loving father would cycle there.
877
driving is fine.
301 8970 is her phone number.
With tears in his eyes.
In a minute, it's going to be your opportunity. Is this you that Michael Norton's research is describing, somebody who feels bad about themselves some things are fairly mundane, like a trip to the airport kind of thing, as opposed to caring for a sick relative or that sort of thing. Is he describing you? He's describing me and you, I think. Is this you too?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
So it's everybody.
What time was the lift to the airport, Jim?
What?
Was it 3 o'clock in the morning?
4:30 in the morning.
4:30
But I'm up at 5 o'clock, so it wasn't like a big deal.
Wow.
Oh,
she's never going to forgive me.
She's never going to forgive you.
No, she believed me. She was happy that we did what we did. 877-301-8970. Why'd you decide to look
at her on the phone?
Why'd you decide? I hope actually you could, but you won't. Why did you decide to do this? I'm always curious when you have these odd sort of pursuits. I think it's great, but why did you even think of this?
So this project, my student, Jimena, who I mentioned earlier, she is incredibly interested in how couples make decisions together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, that topic, she could study that for 1,000 years. What goes on in couples when they make decisions about anything is just insane, right? So she looks for these examples in the world where it's, people trying to figure out some sort of social thing. Do we care about each other? How's this going? And it goes off the rails so quickly sometimes. And then we end up in these insane days-long emails about who's going to pick up who, and it's why. Why is it so hard to navigate relationships, especially in, like, when there's products involved or services involved? Like the wedding registry, we're mixing up, are we friends or am I buying you something in the Uber kind of thing? So those sorts of situations really mess us up a lot of the time. And Jimena found this Snoo product, and that was really what set it off.
S-N-O-O, right?
S-N-O-O, that really set it off, which is the rage against this product.
Exactly.
What's going on
there?
That's
interesting. You're a negligent, horrible parent.
Yeah. What kind of a parent?
Kid. Exactly. What kind of a parent wouldn't want to get up 4 or 5 times in the middle of the night?
Right.
What a bum. We're talking to Harvard Business School's Michael Norton. When we come back, we're going to take your calls at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, or BPR at WGBH.org, or you can tweet us at Boss Public Radio.
The
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, this whole conversation is making me really uncomfortable. We're talking to Harvard Business School's Michael Norton about his research, which looks at how oversimplifying the way we care for our family and friends can backfire, meaning we'll feel bad about ourselves, forget how our behavior is received by the person we're trying to help. We're taking your calls and ask you if this has happened to you at 877-301-8970. You ever been called up by your kids or friends for taking a shortcut? And if you haven't, have you called yourself out instead of driving your kid to school? Did you call a cab or ride hailing service rather than, I don't know, making a homemade meal when a friend was sick? Did you call Grubhub? 877-301-8970. You know what really stuck with me through that break? I was thinking a lot about Marjorie and her family yesterday. This has happened to me about 1,000 times. Is, in light of the fact that takeout and prepared foods at a good place are at least as good as I know Marjorie and I can cook, maybe not everybody at home. So even though intellectually we know the thing that we're going to give to our family or friends is probably going to be higher quality, I am exactly like she is. If there are going to be 6 dishes when people are coming over, I have to make 2 of them, even though I'm at best a C-plus cook. And if I got it at Whole Foods or Myers and Chang or whatever, it'd be an A.
Yeah.
So what is that?
And it's funny, too, because that you have some implicit ratio,
right?
So some are okay, but not all 6.
But
it
what is that about?
Yeah.
But where does that come from? What's the genesis of that? We're
trying to, you know, these people we love, we're having them over. We're trying to show that we love them and we're friends.
We have to exert ourselves to show that we really care.
We think that by doing this is the best way to show somehow that we, you know, we really care about them.
Before we go to the calls, Jim.
Yep.
Jo just sent an email and she said, Jim, your daughter would have preferred that you drive her to the airport, but didn't want to make you feel bad.
Oh, jeez.
I had the same situation when I was young, and she really wanted the ride.
What's that person's name?
Joe.
Can you block her?
Can we ask Joe, though? Can we ask Joe a different question? If Jim were your father, would you have wanted Jim to drive you?
Exactly.
That's an excellent point.
Let's go. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Let's start with Derry in Foxborough. Hi.
Hello, Derry. How are you?
Hi.
Hi.
A long-time listener, first-time caller. I finally got through.
We're really glad you did. What's up?
Thank you. So I wanted to let you know that this conversation that you're having on me really resonates with me because my friends and I have had similar conversations based around, like, gift cards because we all love getting gift cards, but we all feel guilty giving gift cards even if we know that's what people want. And then we start thinking, well, how about a gift card and we'll give them a little something to open so that we showed we tried.
I love this call. The gift card is the perfect example of what we're talking about.
Right?
So how do you resolve it? You do a hybrid, right? Is that what you just said? You give a little something that is more thoughtful and give a card because that's what they want, right?
Yes, and sometimes it's just a matter of making sure that the card you write has a lot of sentiment in it. And maybe, you know, this will be a good chance for us to get together and go out to dinner. So,
brilliant call.
You know, a lot of people in my age bracket, we're kind of divesting of stuff. We're not trying to accumulate more stuff. And it's more experiential things. So, we kind of supplement with something like that.
Well, let me just tell you, if you read Michael's book, the one takeaway from his book is that people, for us, is that, Marjorie, I mention this all the time, people far prefer an experience as a gift. Is that not true? Mm-hmm. Than a thing. Derry, that was a fabulous phone call. The gift card is perfect, right?
There's a whole industry. I think when you buy gift cards online and it says, what font do you want to have on it? What color do you want to have on it? All these choices. I mean, it's a gift card, but it's trying to allow you to do a little bit of work on it so that when it goes to the person, they say, oh, he picked the one with the red back.
Do you really think that is the motivation?
Absolutely.
So that you feel that you've engaged rather than just clicking submit and pay.
Absolutely. And in the offline world, people wrap gift cards in elaborate boxes with ribbons and everything like that, again, to show that they put some effort into the at least wrapping the gift.
Oh, yeah.
Even if the gift card came, you know,
I do that
free.
With money.
Let's go to Jesse and Stone. I'm your next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking to Michael Norton from Harvard Business School. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. How you doing?
Great.
In listening to your conversation, all I could think of was the five love languages. I'm really not a gift person. Mm-hmm. I'm an acts of service person. So I would much rather take somebody to the airport than have to think of a gift. Go on the registry, point and click, get them what they want, rather than have to think about what to give them.
And what do you think? What does that say about you, do you think, Jesse?
Well, I feel really good when I can do something for somebody.
Hmm. Ooh, what's the five love languages thing? I don't know about that.
You don't?
No, no.
Well, let's see. Acts of Service is one. It's a book.
Oh, it's a book.
It's a book by, I want to say, a man named Chapman. And it talks about everybody has one strong love language.
Huh.
And words of affirmation is one. Acts of service. Gifts. Touch. And I'm drawing a blank on the fifth
one. It's okay.
One.
So Joe Biden would be the touch. He's going to rethink his acts his acts of love, I guess, since he's been touching people.
Yes.
Hey, thank you for that, Jesse.
Gary Chapman is. I thought I had heard of it, but when she described it, I hadn't. The five love languages.
Isn't the fifth one undermining remarks? I think that's a common love language.
Oh, undermining remarks.
Certainly in Irish families.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I wish she hadn't hung up because I think she was giving, at least from my perspective, conflicting messages. She said she'll go on the registry and do that, which is sort of the non-thoughtful gift. But then she'll do something. She wants to do something for somebody and act, like taking them to the airport, which is exactly the effort-laden thing that you say causes us to be more self-satisfied, right?
Yeah, I wasn't sure the two of those going together, but I do think the idea of what counts as doing something for someone, different people mean very different things by what it means to, like, I could get you something off your registry and feel like I really did something for you, but another person could get something off your registry and feel they didn't do anything at all. So it is that feeling that I want to do something for you, and many people at least seem to think that that means putting a lot of effort into something instead of anything else that the person might
want. Well, a couple of people have said, and this is including Lynn, that she checks the registry to get a sense of the recipient's style and color preferences. Then she selects one of the less expensive items to pair it with a personal gift that she wants to give.
That's like Derry. That's like the first person who called. Yeah. By the way, one of our coworkers said in the Five Love Languages book also talks about how the gift you prefer to receive can be different from the language you like to do. And the five things are receiving gifts, quality time, words of affirmation, acts of service, and physical touch. So those are the five deals.
I never heard of that book. Have you?
Okay. What about like grudging admiration? Is that one of them or is that a different book? That might be the follow-up.
877-301.
Yeah, or never forget the grudges.
89-70. You know, you don't have enough answers for me, Michael. I want to know. I can't get my mind off. I've gotten moved past not taking my kid to the airport. I can't get over the meal thing. I don't think I've ever... I do a decent amount of cooking.
You're
but again,
very good. I had that shepherd's pie.
No, I know
delicious.
That. Well, actually, it was Dory Greenspan's cookbook
Greenspan.
When she was in here. I made
it
this weekend.
Delicious.
But you know why I did that?
Why?
Because people were over, and I felt I had to make something because the other stuff I had bought. That was it. And I had no idea. And by the way, it was a pain in the neck. I mean, it took me hours, and I could have been suspended. But I, without thinking, I felt exactly as you and Marjorie had described. Let's go back to the phones. 877-301-8970.
Maureen in Boston. Hi, Maureen.
Hello, Maureen.
Hi. Couple of things. One is I just want to say something about the snoo, because a year ago, my second grandchild was born and she was going through a pretty colicky phase. I literally would have paid, you know, for a nuclear reactor to be installed in my daughter's house to quiet this baby down. And by the way, I'm also a pediatrician, so I want to say the snoo is very expensive. And some of the remarks, I think, came from... There were a lot of celebrities buying it, and it was pretty, you know, it was pretty hyped up. But I was ready to just send in my, you know, order it because we were going crazy. So I do want to mention the issue about the sort of, you know, when it's elaborate or extravagant. I want to solve the problem of homemade meals. I have made my mark in my group of family and friends that I cannot cook. And it's actually a disaster. And so that's like off the plate. I don't cook. It's fine. But I think I get this from my mother because my mother was a real meat and potatoes cook, and she was good at that. She was terrible at other things. And up the block, growing up in 50s and 60s, Queens, was the original Martha Stewart, Mrs. Daly. And she was always baking, you know, every night, and she had linen on the table. And my mother just thought she was crazy. But she made a gingerbread house every year that probably rivaled the one in the White House.
Oh, yes.
And my brother was nuts about this and said, Mommy, make a gingerbread house. And she finally said, all right. She went into New York City to what was then the German section of New York. There were very big ethnic neighborhoods where there were these amazing bakeries. She bought the most extravagant gingerbread house. She got my father to pick her up. They drove home. Just as my brother was coming home from school, she said, oh, Billy, the gingerbread house is ready. Pulls out a completely frosted, decorated gingerbread house. You know, he was in like second grade at the time, so he didn't get it. And said, oh, it just came out perfectly. My brother was so impressed, and the Daily kid ran up the block and said, you can't believe what, you know, Billy's mother did as a gingerbread
house.
That's
great.
My mother, being a good Irish Catholic, confessed to Mrs. Daly that it actually was bought in the city. But
hey, Maureen, my brother, did you know that Martha Stewart had to ship her family out of the house at Christmas time so she could make the gingerbread house and decorate? They weren't allowed. Remember her husband and kids? She shipped them out.
Yeah.
Yeah, shipped them out. They couldn't be there. She was too busy decorating the tree.
Hey, Maureen, you're a great storyteller. That was great.
Thank
you very much for the call.
Thank you very, very much. Paul says, this is very sweet, Paul, it's important to give care, not take care of others. How about that?
I mean, the person who answered Maureen's call, one of our coworkers, said that her basic theme was it's a thought that counts, like the mother getting. I mean, that is like the short version of your. That's what we think. That is essentially a summary of your research. We think isn't that what it is?
We also think that what counts for us as thought and caring will automatically be the same
exactly.
thing that counts for the other person. So. People think, you know, geez, I'd like to be – if I'm in the hospital, I'd like someone to visit me for 8 hours. And then you think, well, I bet everyone wants that. And then so you're caring for someone by going and visiting them for 8 hours. They might not want you to be there at all. So we are thinking that our definition of doing something is the right one, and then we just visit it on everyone else, whether it's what they want or not.
And when the other person convincingly says they don't want the – extra effort thing, whether it's the cooking of the meal or the ride to the airport or $500,000 to coach at USC, whatever it is, does that change our mind, or are we totally focused on the notion that we know what will make us happiest, which is what matters?
It doesn't seem to help that much. So even when we know that the other person, as in your case with your daughter, even when we know the other person prefers something else, we still have this lingering sense that we didn't do a good job taking care.
Gene and Brockton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling. Hi, Gene.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one in reverse. My daughter's best friend got married a few months ago, and I went to her wedding registry. I bought her a very expensive KitchenAid mixer.
Oof.
Which was on the list.
They are expensive.
She came to see me when they got back from their honeymoon and brought me the thank you note in person. And she said to me, well, it was really nice and I really liked it, but, and I said, but, my hobby is making leaded glass panels. I make big ones. And she said, I was really hoping that you'd make something in leaded glass just for us.
Oh, no. Oh.
I didn't know how to respond to that. I was like, okay, if you want glass, I'll make you glass. But I didn't know what to say to that. Or if I spent like $295.
But who's counting?
Right.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I can't believe.
Well, there's a lesson in that, Gene. Thank you.
Said that,
they kind of set you up to fail on that one,
I
think. By the way, that reminded me of an amazing story. And now I forget where I heard it. A mother-in-law was complaining about her daughter-in-law because they had gotten her for her birthday. They knew she loved to knit. So they got her some very expensive yarn and things for her to knit things for their daughter-in-law. So then the mother-in-law's birthday came up, and the daughter-in-law gave her a beautiful sweater that she'd knitted for her. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the mother-in-law was writing into this advice columnist to say, I'm furious because all she did was re-gift the yarn I gave her. So there's someone who doesn't value the effort at all. In fact, they only value the cost, I think, of the product. But again, this idea of putting an effort or not, the emotions it provokes are so strong in so many people.
So let's go to Mansfield, where Jennifer's on the phone. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
Hi.
I have been tortured by this topic for all of my
adult great.
Life. Wow.
It kind of reinvents itself. It comes back in different ways, shapes, or form, depending on the holiday and who's coming. Before I tell you my specific story, I will say that, generally speaking, I have attempted to make my peace with mostly buying pre-made foods for my events. But it's kind of a double-edged sword, because there's always the group of people who are going to kind of look at you critically, or you believe, for bringing your food in. And then there are others, if you make their food, it's so crappy that they're going to be looking. You see, it's like if you're stuck in that spot, you can't win. But a couple of years ago, I actually make, for a part of a big church fundraiser, we do this like cookie walk where you can buy homemade cookies by the pound. And so I make a batch of cookies every year. It's like an almond sugar cookie with an almond glaze. And I make, it's something like 8 dozen of them that you have to make. And
wow.
They're gone super fast. They're like sold out immediately. So after a couple of years of selling these cookies, and I get a request to make them, another person in the church asked if she could have the recipe. And I shared it with her. And it turns out the recipe is like a freaking Betty Crocker recipe. You just take a bag of sugar cookie mix and you doctor it up. And when she got the recipe, she made it for her cookie swap, and somebody else asked her for the recipe, and she shared it with them, and they criticized her about using, like, well, you could always just tell people that you made the mix from scratch. So then she came back and told me, and it was like third-hand criticism for buying bagged cookie, and I was like, I've been tortured about that for about the last 3 years now.
I think you should be, actually, Jennifer. I think it's
that's
you
horrible.
Should be.
What
horrible.
Kind of a person?
Jennifer,
yeah.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Makes,
for the
makes,
call.
Yeah. What's the expression? Makes the mix from scratch?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, Aaron from Melrose, you would be next. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Love the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Great. So I was just, I'm 33, and I every time I go home, I'm always amazed by how much kind of consumerism there is in my family. We have everything you can imagine, and we don't even know what to buy each other for Christmas now, or it just becomes too much. And so I just had a 33rd birthday, so I thought I would ask friends, not for things. I don't want things. You know, things bought everywhere else. I want compliments, or I want feedback, or vocal, verbal gifts. Right, things that are perhaps mean more, but they're just not clutter. They're gonna do nothing in your house one day. You know.
And how'd they react?
Aghast, and then they were cool with it, and they gave me some fun feedback. You know, so. Yeah,
what do you mean?
Think about.
What kind of feedback? Like your clothes look nice, or you're a good-looking guy, or you're working out, or what kind of feedback?
Yeah. Well, any kind of career-wise, or things you can do better to be a better friend, or relationship advice, or just take a moment to think about how to, you know, I think verbally you can really give gifts to, we don't really do too much to communicate with each other, to help each other out with their life. And so that instead of just another cheese. Plate, you
well,
know?
You are so grown up. I hate yeah. feedback. I really. No, I'm kidding, Aaron. That was great.
But if you get it on your birthday, people would have to lie. So I think if you get specifically the birthday feedback, you're great.
But he was essentially asking people to do something that does require more effort, to expend emotional capital. I mean, he was doing it because he's concerned about too much consumerism. But essentially, the givers then couldn't do the easy thing, go out and buy a present for $49, but rather have to look them in the eyes and, I mean, it, yeah, you know.
Think about something.
And think about yeah. something. This is a great one. So the moral of the story is what?
One final thing, actually, which I forgot, which is important, is people are pretty insensitive to the amount of time you spent on it.
Oh, that's important.
So they're sensitive to whether you put effort in or not. But if you spent 30 minutes making the cookies or an hour or 2 hours
Doesn't
making the
difference.
Cookies, they don't seem to care that much. So if you're stuck in a, I've got to do something effortful to show I care, pick the cookie that just require the one egg.
Michael Norton is the Harold M. Brealey Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. His latest book is Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. Up next, writer T.C. Boyle is here to talk about his latest book about Timothy Leary. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of our greatest hits today, which includes writer T.C. Boyle, who is here to talk about his latest book. It's called Outside Looking In. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. In his latest novel, T.C. Boyle drops in on the dropout era of Timothy Leary. It's set in the 1960s when the real-life Leary was running the Harvard Psilocybin Project, where self-administered drug use seemed to have been the principal form of research. At the time, no one was sure if Leary was a shaman or a sham, a certified genius or a questionable guru. By way of Boyle's imagination, you get some answers. The book is called Outside Looking In. T.C., it's great to see you again.
Likewise, my dear fellow, and you too, Marjorie. And by the way, you have classed up your act with this studio.
We really have.
Last time, if I'm not mistaken, it was in a cave down by the river.
Exactly.
No, we still have the cave.
Very ratty.
It's an adjunct.
And there were a bunch of turkeys in there. And incidentally, I feel bad for the woman who got turkey pecked. But ultimately, I am on the side of the turkeys. They're getting their own back just a little bit.
Yeah.
Look what we do to them. I mean, we cut their heads off and their feet, and we stuff them full of Mrs. Cubbins and roast them and eat them.
That's a very fine point.
So they peck us once in a while.
No, they do need an advocate. I think you're the man for the job, T.C.
Yeah. But, you know, T.C., you are famous as a writer who zones in on, you know, crackpots and ideologues and iconoclasts and crazy people. I suppose Timothy Leary was just the perfect person, our own local crackpot. Was the guy to zero in on.
He was indeed. Don't forget, I wrote Drop City back in 2003, which is about the late hippie movement, something I know something about. I stepped back to a time before all this happened to find out where is it coming from. For us, as hippies, he was preposterous. He was this old guy on television muttering in robes, obviously his brain gone. But to go back in history to this period at Harvard in 62, he was a dynamic, handsome, charismatic guy and the hot young psychologist in America, you know?
He was. And he persuaded lots of people to join him, which is what you're talking about.
Okay, I have to confess. I did all of my drug stuff before I went to graduate school. In fact, graduate school is what saved my life.
Oh, really?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I was a bad boy in New York. At 25, I woke up, grew up, and went to graduate school, University of Iowa. I had a mentor there for my PhD, Frederick P.W. McDowell. All he wanted me to do was enjoy literature and learn. I thought about, what if I had been a psychology student of Leary's in 62? He would have wanted me to take drugs. He would have insisted, in fact, if I were to be his student and in his inner circle. And he did it, by the way, he did it honestly and from his heart. He really believed that the psilocybin he took in Mexico, the magic mushrooms, were a new way of getting into psychology.
Was all this legal? It was legal then, was it not
legal? Yeah, it was legal until 66 when the feds caught up to it.
Yeah, well, I remember those books. When were those Carlos Castaneda books that were all written about the magic mushrooms?
Yeah,
and it was going to be the spiritual savior of everybody if we followed him. And I think there was a lot of that going on with Leary, too, right?
Well, back to Castaneda. I mean, yeah, that was around when I was a hippie. And the books were too boring to read, though. We were having a lot of fun without books.
Yeah, okay.
Leary now, though? I was really interested. I mean, we had, what's-his-face, Michael Pollan on a year or so ago when he wrote, How to Change Your Mind, about the secrets. And he was talking, I mean, most people know Pollan as a food guy, obviously. And he started experimenting, I guess is a fair verb, and talking about, why is there so much interest in Leary now? What is it, 60 years after the fact?
I don't know, but I know Michael, and in fact, I will be doing a talk with him for the New York Times next week in Berkeley.
Great.
Yeah, and Ayelet Waldman also.
But why you then? Why now for Leary and you?
Well, you know, I had written about the hippies before and about changing your consciousness. The book opens with an acid trip. I don't know. It's something in the air. I finished this book at the end of 2017, so I didn't know about Michael's book or Ayelet's, which have come out recently. I did read an article that Michael wrote in The New Yorker several years ago about LSD coming back into use in psychiatry, and that just set some light bulbs off in my head, I guess. And there was other stuff in The New York Times and the press.
So, T.C. Boyle, did you ever know somebody whose first name was Fitzhugh?
Fitzhugh, I
was
love
trying
that.
To say, I don't know if I have ever...
Very waspy.
Fitzhugh Loney, is that the character's name?
That is correct. No, I never have. However, my daughter is pregnant and going to have a child. We don't know whether it's a boy or girl.
Congratulations.
She was with me on the German tour for this book recently, and we went into the botanical gardens to do a film, a little TV thing, and in between takes, there was this plant called the elephant foot plant. It's about this big, little green sprout on top. It's called Elephantenfuß. So, I'm insisting that she name the kid, boy or girl, Elephantenfuß. What do you think?
I don't think
she's
resisting. I don't think she's going to go for it.
We had Dweezil on the show a couple of months ago, by the way.
Okay.
Dweezil Zappa. Yeah. That's not much worse or different.
Name. But, you know, there was this whole thing back in the 60s and 70s, this idea that you talk about kind of doing nonstop drugs and the free love and having sex with everybody and living in communes was somehow, you know, going to be the savior of the world. And I think there were certain people that bought into that. And obviously the people that followed him were among them, right?
Well, I experienced free love briefly, but now it's become the most expensive love in history. Because I married her.
Oh, okay.
Only kidding.
She'll
only
love
kidding.
That, by the way. Okay. We'll make sure we
yeah,
tell her.
Okay.
Yeah, like everybody else, I lived in a big house full of people. Hey, it's also great. But then you grow up and you realize that maybe it's not going to work out. As Alan Watts said, you don't need to persistently open that door. Once the phone rings, you answer it and you hang it up and you're enlightened. But, you know, as with any drug and drug dealer, Leary just got sucked into this.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Loneys? The Loneys are fictional characters who are at the center of your book. Tell us about the Loneys.
So Fitzhugh is sort of like me, although he was older when he went to graduate school. He was in his early 30s. I was 25. He's from a long line of Irish drunks, as I am. Mm-hmm. I'm the first ever in my family to go to college. He desperately wanted to be a professor, but he knocked up Joni when they were undergrads, and she never finished school, and he had to work as a high school psychologist for many years. Now he is back, and he's at Harvard, and he wants one thing only. That is to be a straight arrow and get his degree and become a professor. But as we said earlier in the show, to be part of this inner circle of this charismatic professor, you had to take psilocybin. Absolutely had to. And so the book opens with a session. He and Joni going to their professor's house on a Saturday night for a session and their first experience of taking a psychedelic drug.
And they both have their lives, once they interact with Leary, take sort of different directions and different reactions. Do they not?
Isn't that the way it always is?
Well, it is. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, or do you not want to share too much?
No, of course, of course.
Well, tell us.
So they are enlightened. They are enlightened by the drug. What it does is it disarms your editing function of your brain. You know, we'd all be schizophrenic if everything coming to us was not filtered out. This is why you see colors and visions, because all the sense impressions are washing into you. So they had remarkable experiences. But the thing is, the communal living that went with it, they were a kind of cult. And Leary and Alpert were the cult leaders. Got them off the track of what they're supposed to be doing. You know, in the beginning, Leary would have people fill out questionnaires. Have you done this before? What was your experience? And write essays about it. But after a while, they just said, okay, come on, let's get high.
You know? Yeah. And the other thing was all the sex. I mean, you talk about picking sex partners out of a sombrero kind of thing.
All true. All these facts are true to what went on at Millbrook, where, of course, as people will know, Leary was given for $1 a year a mansion by one of his very wealthy acolytes so he could continue his experiments. And everyone moved in, the grad students, their children, hangers-on.
So but there was a Mexico moment, too, was there not?
Yes.
It was was it Cambridge to Mexico to Millbrook? Or
yes.
Was that the...
Yes, yes, yes. He rented a hotel in the off-season in Zihuatanejo on the beach. And this was the Summer Institute, where he could take everybody and they could experiment. And what the experiments, of course, became experiments with interpersonal relations, you know, as well as with taking these drugs. He was kicked out of Harvard and eventually kicked out of Mexico with pressure from the federal drug authorities here, putting pressure on getting rid of him. And Millbrook was offered as a refuge to him.
We're talking to T.C. Borrow. The book is Outside Looking In. It's a novel, but it's based on what went on when Timothy Leary was running, I guess you could say, sort of his own little cult. What do you think, after writing this, what did you think of Leary? Was there some legitimacy, at least at the beginning, as you said, when he was asking for the questionnaires, or was he just a total kind of creepy guy?
As I said at the outset here, my opinion of his was revised because he was quite sincere at what he was doing. But he also got addicted to his notoriety and his fame rode on doing these drugs in massive quantities constantly. And he was an addictive personality and an alcoholic to begin with. And he just didn't understand where it's going to go.
He encountered fame along the way, too. There were a lot of very famous... Tell him some of the people he encountered in his travels.
Well, he encountered Ginsberg, for instance. As an Allen Ginsberg. And, you know, various celebrities.
John and
Ferguson.
Yoko, right? No? Yes?
I don't know about that. That comes after my time. Okay. Again, by the way, I could have
You're just covering a couple of years.
That's right. I could have written a 10,000-page novel. His life was fascinating. His running from the law, his breaking out of prison, all of this is fascinating. But I'm much more interested in his effect on these people, his followers. What would it have been like? You know, my job is to inhabit the characters. I give you the real history, which fascinates me. But what would it have been like to be there?
You mentioned coming from a long line of alcoholics, and obviously there was not much moderation going on in this with Leary or with Fitzhugh and his wife. I mean, it always fascinates me is why can some people stop, even with cocaine or even with crack cocaine, and some people, it's just the downhill slide. And
first of all, you can't do prohibition. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
All drugs should be legal and sold at the CVS pharmacy.
If you're
going to be addicted, you're going to be addicted. There's nothing anybody can do about it, and everybody is going to try it. You may remember my story back in the Eocene. So, you know, I used to shoot heroin. I was did everything. My daughter was in fifth grade going to the D.A.R.E. program at her school in L.A., and she asked me to go with her to the culmination of this. And I wrote a little story about it because I had very mixed feelings. It's indoctrination, but yet, fifth grade, for God's sake. Anyway, at the end of the story, he's dropping her off at her mother's house, and she says, "Dad, I just wanted to ask you, did you ever do drugs, or Mom?" And he says, "No," and shakes his head, "No." So I told her straight up the truth, because no is never the answer to this infinitely seductive question. Hey, man, you want to do a hit of this? Everybody has to fend for him or herself, and no amount of education is going to protect you. And there's luck, there's genetic variations. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I don't know either, but it's a fascinating question, why some people do and some can't stop.
I can give you one further piece of advice or information about this that I know personally. In order to be a junkie, you have to want to be a junkie. That is, you have no hope and you don't care. You don't care about anything. And I think this is part of the problem why our underclasses so often become addicted. They're bored. They have nothing productive to do. There's no job for them. If you told me now, let's say the Great Orange One banned all writing in this country and I couldn't write anymore, in 2 weeks I'd be back on the streets doing drugs. I mean, come on.
Le Grand Orange. So we only got this book last night, T.C.'s. We both just started. Is there a moral to the story?
Oh, come
for
on,
you?
Man. I know you guys are busy, but I'm willing to come to your house and read it aloud to you for $10,000 an hour.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
You know what? And it's just I love you two both. Not 10,000 each. You can
that's
I'll
beautiful
read it
together.
We got the cut
so,
rate.
Well, I did last night because I didn't have much time. I read 20 pages, then 20 pages, then 20 pages.
Yeah.
And the conclusion I reach, which maybe you may embarrass me when I say this is what I read into this, having read 60 pages only of this, is that you can't ever escape reality. Is that where you're going? Or
I like that interpretation.
Do you really,
so.
Or you're being kind to me?
You have to realize, you know me well, I'm an artist. I don't start with a political point of view, although, of course, you read my books, you know what I stand for. I think art is a seduction. I'm trying to tell you a story. I don't have a plan when I begin. I don't have a message to give. That all happens as we go along. And, of course, I wouldn't want to say what I think the message is because then it destroys it for percipient readers like yourself,
but I didn't,
my dear fellow.
I did not embarrass myself just now, did I?
Perfectly, yeah.
Okay, fine.
Sure.
Okay.
May I ask you a little bit about the story you wrote for The New Yorker, which
sure.
I find absolutely fascinating.
Sure.
You talked about the fire and then floods in a place you've lived for 25 years, I believe.
Montecito.
Tell us what happened out there.
Hmm. So you may recall that I wrote A Friend of the Earth back in 2000 about global warming, and before that, the Tortilla Curtain, in which invariably the fire is followed by the flood because it burns off all the chaparral. There's nothing to hold back the water. So it was January 9th, a year ago. We're all in bed in Montecito. 2:30 in the morning, there was a lightning strike, very rare, big boom, and I, fortunately, turned over and went back to bed. My neighbors weren't so lucky. We live on the hill just above the creek that flooded, two blocks away. 23 of my neighbors were killed, buried in mud and swept out to sea. The power of this is unimaginable. Thousands of cars crushed like in that James Bond movie. It's crushed this big. Boulders the size of this, rolling down like bowling balls. The power of it is astonishing. And I had to reflect. The New Yorker asked me a week in if I would go look at things and write about it. And it was wonderful because I was absolutely crushed by what had happened to my village, which was, by the way, shut down like a police state for at least a month. And it gave me a way to get it out of myself.
But this was after a fire.
Yeah, okay,
because
so...
before, I mean, you talk about being up on the roof with a hose,
oh, yeah.
And your family's already been evacuated because they were warned. You were back at hosing down to hope...
I love our house, Marjorie.
Yes.
It's from 1909. It's made entirely of redwood. It would burn in a heartbeat.
Oh, gosh.
When we left in December, we were in a motel for 12 days in December prior to this. The final day when this pall of smoke, black smoke, blotted the sky out and the cops made me leave, I thought I'd never see the house again. But fortunately, the firemen had a month. It took a whole month for it to come up from Ventura. And they did their job. My sister-in-law
stayed with you.
Oh, yeah.
She was in the same boat, but her house survived too, I believe, right?
Yes,
yeah.
And the fire had now moved to us. So it was absolutely terrifying. I will say something. Debbie Reynolds saved my life.
How was that?
Well, my wife had stayed in this motel upstate because you can't breathe that smoke. I was home trying to save the house. When the cops kicked me out, I drove back up there. Berserk. I thought the house was going for sure. And she said, let's watch the fire on TV. I said, I can't watch the fire on TV. I'll be in the insane asylum. Meanwhile, on TCM came on this absolutely crappy Debbie Reynolds, Fisher movie.
I thought I watched it.
I forget. But anyway, it saved my life because I didn't know if the house burned. The next morning I woke up and found miraculously it had been saved.
So you're back there now.
Yes.
And I would be a basket case thinking about the next wildfire and the next flood.
And about the 23. I mean, do
and
you?
And about the neighbors.
I knew three of them, but not very closely. But that doesn't really matter. I mean,
yeah.
I knew them. I could recognize them. Don't forget, you East Coasters. You know, you have it so easy here. So there's a little ice once in a while. It's an ongoing disaster. I don't know if you noticed, the entire state was on fire all summer.
Indeed.
It was, but we have hurricanes, but you know the hurricane is coming, so you can get prepared. This is like the thing in California that was so scary to me is that before people even had a chance, their homes are engulfed.
We had no idea. Some people heard the boom, walked outside on the lawn to look, and immediately swept away by a wall of mud, 20 feet high, trees, cars. Here's a story for you. When we first moved to our house we're in now, it's 26 years ago from L.A., beautiful house, wonderful. That was just around when the Northridge quake happened. It's 70 miles south of us.
Yeah.
But we were jolted out of bed at 4:30 in the morning. The house was shaking like this. And I said this to my wife. I didn't say, oh, my God, or look out, or get under bed. I said just this. I told you we should have moved back to New York.
But so you're gonna stay there. You're not thinking about relocating.
It's my home. I love it. That's California. I just pray that we're going to be okay. And by the way, it's not going to burn for a while because everything's already burned.
Yeah, that's true. And it was amazing too to me how some houses you see a one house standing among ashes.
It's amazing, Marjorie. So where the riverbeds were, there are houses I looked at for 25 years driving by every day, like in the neighborhood, like here. Mm-hmm. Nothing but dirt. Nothing. I mean, not a bent pipe, not a brick. Everything just swept to the sea.
So do you think, you wrote about climate change, you just said, quite a while ago now. Do you think that people are a little concerned about this?
This is Marjorie's obsession.
Well, I'm obsessed because
so you know,
I think we're doing nothing, and I find it very scary. And I love Cape Cod, which is a peninsula, obviously, with water on both sides.
Oh, yeah.
The whole thing. I mean, I can't imagine.
Well, we have, you know, for a long time now, we've had the shills for the oil company running our country and buying off our politicians. So, of course, they don't care what happens to the earth in 50 years or even 20 years. They just want to, you know, buy a new Mercedes tomorrow. So I think we're in deep trouble on that score. But you're talking about it, my talking about it, my writing about it all the time. And yet it awakens people, but it's like the last election. You know, I'm only talking to the anointed. They all agree with me.
Yeah.
How do you touch the people who just are manipulated by Fox News and propaganda and believe that that's the truth? You can't.
TC, before you go, you mentioned early on in discussing Outside Looking In about your drug use decades ago. Did you do anything during the writing of this book to get you in this? No, I'm serious.
Back to Michael Pollan. Michael had never done drugs before.
I know
this,
that.
And he did it as a journalist to see an experiment. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't consider it. My mind is hanging by the thinnest thread right now.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a hell of a thread, TC Boyle.
T.C. Boyle's latest novel is Outside Looking In. Up next, Richard Blanco joins us for a crash course on metaphors, similes, and more. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Poet Richard Blanco, giving us a crash course on literary tools that can make your poetry more poetic.
So I think your theme is today, Richard, that if you want to be a successful poet, you shouldn't write things like autumn leaves look like mixed vegetables.
Well, it all depends. Yeah, I thought since it's National Poetry Month, we'd do like a little tutorial. I think we did that last
year.
Great.
On the power of figurative language.
Oh, good.
And it's such an essential part of poetry. And I think, and it's essential because then we really think about it. That's essentially a fundamental way in which we learn, in which we think as human beings, right? We always learn by comparison. We learn what something is by what it's like or what it's not. And it really has this incredible power in poetry. And so I'll give you an example of sort of the different kinds of languages that poetry can use. So if we say the autumn leaves are beautiful, okay, whoop-de-whoop, right? Abstract language, there's no imagery. Now, if we say the maroon and ochre of autumn leaves, okay, now we have a visual, now we have something tactile, right? Now we're starting to paint a picture. But if we say the autumn leaves like confetti, something different happens, right? So all the qualities that we associate with something like confetti suddenly becomes attached to the abstract idea of autumn and beauty or celebration or death or whatever you want to call it. Or in a way, confetti is like sort of a farewell, right? So
I would be saying the autumn leaves are beautiful. That's what I feel.
They're beautiful.
I mean, I'm a literal beautiful kind of guy. Not much. I'm serious. I mean, that's the difference between you two, who are writers and the likes of
me.
Well,
you know, I was going to say, just in terms of, I mean, I was just a newspaper reporter. I'm no poet. But I just remember early on in my career, one of my bosses saying to me, when I used to do a lot of crime stories, don't tell me they smoke cigarettes. Tell me they smoke Lucky Strikes unfiltered or Marlboros. And I remember there was this murder where this poor woman went to the roof of her building with her killer in the elevator. She didn't realize he was her killer. And there was a single light bulb on the top of the on the ceiling with no cover around it. And he said, look at that detail. And it's true. It made it all the more
it makes
ominous,
all the, right? Because it
even for just a newspaper reporter,
It creates the whole setting for you.
Yeah.
So back to your comment about mixed vegetables if the leaves are falling.
Yes, like awful.
Well, it all depends on the poem too. There might be a poem where that may make all the sense in the world. I wouldn't. I'd be hard to find that poem. But
humorous poem, maybe
something, right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's so particular to the poem itself, but also the idea that when you see a real good image or a real good, and I should say that, you know, everybody thinks, oh, metaphor, figurative language, all figurative. Well, the whole idea is to ground the abstract still in literal images, right? I mean, so when you say my love is like a red, red rose, you're trying to take something like abstract to something that's tangible. But I should say that that part of when you hear a great simile or a great piece of figurative language is like, duh, like, of course, there's this great sense of surprise, and yet at the same time, complete logic folds in, right? So it's like, why didn't I, it's this sense of, of course, why didn't I think of that? But I want to say, not just as writers, but also as readers, that this is part of the incredible power. You could go on for lines and lines describing the autumn leaves, or you could come up with just some amazing simile or piece of figurative language that sort of really connects our minds in ways that are almost subconscious, and a different kind of understanding is imparted sort of in between the lines.
But
so
you know
what,
Richard Blanco, when you get it right, and that's what you've been describing, it is really powerful. When you get it wrong,
it's really bad.
It is so, it's such a thud, and it sounds so forced. You know what I mean? I mean, there is
hard to write good poetry, because you really have to concentrate.
Well, it's prose too, by the way, but all good writing does what Richard is describing.
If you had to think of a simile for that light bulb, you would rack your brain. So do you want to try a little bit of the exercise?
Yes, sure.
I don't think so, but sure. Marjorie will at least. Go ahead. Yeah.
Did you do homework? I didn't.
No, I looked at
these things. Was I supposed to actually do them myself?
No. Okay. I find myself, and this is hard to do again because it's out of context.
Oh, you mean
the exercise
you're talking
about.
So
give it to us.
And this I got a tribute to Steve Cohen, and there's this wonderful book called In the Palm of Your Hand, which is my favorite craft. And it's good even for just people that want to, readers who want to learn about how poetry works. Let's try that number two. It says, among her new in-laws, the young wife was as nervous as
mixed vegetables. Go ahead, Marjorie.
Well, you could rack your brain for hours.
I don't know. I would say something that she did. I mean, I can't think like a poet, but I would think, give an example, like among her new in-laws, the young wife dropped the china and jittered, or her hand shook, or she couldn't, you know what I mean? Just make it a visual, concrete thing. But that's not really...
Right.
That's not figurative.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. The compression that a simile brings into a poem is amazing. I was just sitting in the lobby racking my brain, and I've done this exercise with students several times, and it's really not to get it exactly right, but just to let us see how difficult it is. And I was thinking as nervous as a stray cat.
That's a good one.
That is a good one.
But then you got to think about it, because then there's all these connotations of cats and women. there's all sorts of layers that you need to understand. Let's see.
About Young Bride?
Well, that's a pretty good. That's
like
actually
that.
Pretty good.
That
virginal.
That could start working.
Virginal.
Let's see. Anyone of the other pop?
We'll
out
pick another one. We'll try one more, and then we'll get into the poetry.
Let's say it was the old sycamore in the front yard swaying like a blank.
This is humiliating.
Okay.
Like underwear and a clothesline. It's really difficult. And that's why I just wanted us to try it.
Well, it doesn't work with old sycamore, because I was thinking of some sexy young dancer, but I guess
why wouldn't it?
That starts like a...
But not old.
Like
sycamore.
A flamenco...
Yes.
Swaying like a flamenco dancer or a tango dancer.
Yes.
She's good.
Yeah. There she is.
Jimmy could be
a writer someday, you know?
I was telling Jim beforehand, though, newspapers, I don't mean to compare, because there are two different worlds. I mean, there's a lot of lousy newspaper writing. But we had this guy at the Herald years ago. I remember we would start every story with a simile. It was ridiculous. We always used to make fun of him. He would say, like rain pouring down on a spring afternoon, the legislators screamed at each other on Beacon Hill. It was like awful. And they let him get away with it.
Who was it?
It was unbelievable. I'm not going to tell you.
Oh.
but it was awful.
Yeah, well, that brings up another point. I think we're actually we use figurative language constantly in our daily lives also because it's shortcut. It's compression. So, you know, it's not just similes, but metaphors, personification, oxymoron, synesthesia, like when you say... I smelled the fear in the room. You know, that's all. Mm-hmm. All of it is figurative language, oxymoron. Like, it's hot as hell. I mean, cold as hell. Right? Everything is right. So
yeah. We
do use it because it is a very powerful part of language that just lets us communicate rather quickly and rather effectively at times. They turn into cliches after a while.
We can pace the room as restless as a caged lion or caged tiger or something like
yeah.
that.
She's in it. She's into it. She's
apparently
into it.
She is. Can we hear a poem or two that does it?
This is one of my favorite because it has two of the most brilliant, brilliant similes I've ever seen. And it's A Blessing by James Wright. And I think they'll pop out at us when we hear them, but we can go back over them again. A Blessing. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bound softly forth on the grass, and the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture where they have been grazing all day alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. At home once more, they begin munching on the young tufts of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild on her forehead. And the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly, I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom.
That is unbelievable.
So this
ooh.
Is...
and the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin
on
a girl's wrist.
Like, and then, you know, but you see how it all makes sense in context. This, in a way, this is a love poem, and there's this communion with nature. It's also sort of the whole poem, we're not sure if there's really about ponies or these two people that are, right? So even the whole poem is, in a way, can be interpreted as a metaphor. Yeah. But it's like, you're like, of course that's what it must feel mm-hmm. like, as delicate as... And then the other one, the idea of comparing... they bow shyly as wet swans.
Oh, that one's great.
To compare an animal, so you know, it's because of, well, ponies in this case, but still a horse with the same, their necks, right? The way they bow, and then, of course, there's a reference later to black and white. And so just, right, you're like left like, of course, why hadn't I thought of that before?
So I have a question. At the end, when he says that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom, what's... into blossom.
Well,
it's not a simile, obviously, but is it a metaphor?
It's all figurative. So the big large term is figurative language. It's obviously not literal, right?
Yeah.
It's figurative, and so in that sense, there's two ways. Especially with the line break, listeners can't see that, but the line breaks on break into
yeah.
blossom, and so this idea that you become that. In a way, there's a transformation into the very beauty of this moment of nature, that there's a sort of a transcendence outside of the body. We could interpret it in many ways. But yes, it's figurative. And so it ripples and ripples and ripples with meanings and interpretations because it's not literal. But I love this poem also because, I mean, we've done this in class many times. And if you really go back through it with a fine-tooth comb, simile or metafigurative language, of course, you'll see that it's really, in a way, this poem of estrangement between, there's two people in this poem and then there's two ponies, but the other person is completely absent. There's also been interpretations that this has to deal with some kind of terminal illness. So anyway, interesting.
I have a good one actually.
What?
The other person is as absent as Donald Trump's tax returns. Is that that works? Is that the
I
image?
Love it.
Thank
I
you.
Love it.
By the way, you know, while you two are talking, I was waiting for that. Yeah, while you two are talking, I keep rereading this one line. They bow shyly as wet swans. Ooh. You say, do you not? I mean, you really
That's
are a good
great.
Writer, Martin. I know you like that.
I'm not.
No, you
I'm
are
a
really good
writer.
But, you know, when you read something like that, you say to yourself, I'll never be able to do that
right. yes.
Correct.
In my whole life.
Correct.
That's just 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 words yeah. that are just, you're right, so evocative.
They're so
I mean,
evocative.
It's just incredible.
I mean,
but that is a great thing because you think of the swans' long necks and horses have pretty long
right.
necks.
Right, and then the bow, even the
yeah.
gestures. So every
yeah.
every part of, us, of that simile has to work. And then, of course, we're talking. This is there's love, obviously, involved, and you know they love each other. So swans, you know, such a romantic image, even though they're
yeah,
apparently horrible
forever.
Animals. But
I know they
like,
are.
They're like as bad as geese, right?
Okay, so we'll do another one.
Let's do. You want to do a pieces, or you want? Are we want to do? Do we have time to maybe do the Neruda?
Oh, let's do the Neruda.
Okay, so
this is hubba hubba.
So something that this is, this is. So this is, of course, another kind of figurative language, which is personification. This is personifying the tiger. But why he's doing this is because in that action of using something figurative, it's a way to describe love or this ravenous love that he has. And so it's comparing all this idea of el tigre, of the tiger, to, you know, that love that consumes and you want to consume and be consumed and all that. So we'll only have time to do the English, though, right? Because I can do it in Spanish as well. But what do you think? Yeah,
I actually think we could squeeze both
sure.
in. Let's do it. I'd like to hear
okay.
it in Spanish.
El tigre. Soy el tigre. Derecho entre las hojas anchas como lingotes de mineral mojado. El río blanco crece bajo la niebla. Llegas. Desnuda te sumerges, espero. Entonces, en un salto de fuego, sangre, dientes, de un zarpazo, derribo tu pecho, tus caderas. Bebo tu sangre, rompo tus miembros uno a uno. Y me quedo velando por años en la selva. Tus huesos, tu ceniza, inmóvil, lejos del odio y de la cólera. Desarmado en tu muerte, cruzado por las líneas, inmóvil en la lluvia, centinela implacable de mi amor asesino.
I know this is an obvious thought, but I'll say it before you read the English. It's one thing to translate a prose to
yeah,
another
to
language.
Translate.
Can you imagine translating poetry? Have you done that?
It's insane. I can't even do it with my own work. I have a translator.
Do you really?
Well, I don't have the same command of Spanish in terms of that. But
that is amazing.
It's amazing.
To not just translate it, but to capture the feel.
The feel, and then a lot of times what they'll do, or what I've heard, there's a ghost translator. So there's like a literal translator that will just take the words.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, sometimes it's even better that the translator does not know the original language in some way. And they just manipulate the elements of it, and so it's a loose translation, but somehow they're able to capture. Mm-hmm. So I've heard that's one technique. So this is it in English, and I think you'll hear me read it differently because, of course, it's English. The tiger. I am the tiger. I lie in wait for you among leaves broad as ingots of wet mineral. The white river grows beneath the fog. You come, naked, you submerge, I wait. Then, in a leap of fire, blood, teeth, with a claw slash, I tear away your bosom, your hips, drink your blood. I break your limbs one by one, and I remain watching for years in the forest over your bones, your ashes, motionless, far from hatred and anger, disarmed in your death, crossed by lianas, motionless in the rain, relentless sentinel of my murderous love. Now, you could You can barely get away with that in English, but in Spanish, you can totally get away with it much better. Speaking about the differences, it's almost at this it's over the top, right?
Doesn't he what?
Doesn't he have a book of love poems?
Yes, this is certainly the captain's verses. Yeah, yeah. Los versos del capitán.
For your next romance, right. You have to have these at your bedside.
But what I love about here, how he uses figuratively the tiger to describe that kind of, again, ravenous love, that way that we can just love something so much that we just want to consume it, right? And of course, you go one line too far, and we have one of Margie's stories.
That's right.
Journalism story.
That's right. The front page of the Boston Globe.
A tigre.
Exactly.
He was a tiger. He was like a tiger.
May I ask you something? Because I can't be the only one who doesn't understand this. So I am the tiger is personification.
Of the animal, right.
But is it also the person? Is it a metaphor for a person? What's the difference? I get confused by that.
Oh, so personification is basically when you attribute human characteristics to anything.
Right.
In this case, it's an animal. So, you know, it's closer to the idea, of course, because animals are sentient beings, we would assume. But you can write a personification poem in about a teacup speaking. Or even when you do small things like, you know, and it's sometimes so subtle, like trying to think, of course, like example on this popular, like, you know, the train cried, right?
Okay.
That's almost like a slight personification, right?
But what I'm trying to get at, though, is portraying a human being as a tiger, that the tiger is a metaphor for a man, is it also a metaphor or not?
Well, so what we have here is a controlling metaphor. So the whole poem is controlled by this idea of personifying the animal, which then becomes, so there's another layering. Yes, there's another layering. And then the tiger itself, by speaking through the voice of the tiger, he's speaking about love in a way that is figurative and actually, you know, can get to places that speaking literally won't, right? So there are little moments of personification in poems that can happen, like the tulips by Sylvia Plath. There's moments where she personifies tulips or comes back to giving them human characteristics. In this case, this poem is much tighter in the sense of it's all about using that voice, and then the poem itself that controls the whole. So the whole poem is figurative in a way, right?
Okay.
And you'll find that almost every poem I say, in some ways there is nothing literal in a poem, because every little thing in some ways has a little bit of a figurative, your word choice always has a little bit of a figurative ripple. It's supposed to mean something more than just report information, right?
You know, Richard, we're out of time, but can you just, talk about these images and the Sylvia Plath thing you just mentioned, tulips. Could you just read, is it called a stanza? Is that what the...
Yeah.
Can you read just the last stanza of that thing, if you don't mind, so, the walls?
So if anybody's familiar with Sylvia Plath, she's in the hospital. Someone gives her tulips. She's, of course, Sylvia Plath, and she's looking at the world through this incredible lens of... So she's subverting the whole idea of what flowers mean. So is it that last...
The walls also seem...
Right. The walls also seem to be warming themselves. The tulips should be behind bars like dangerous animals. They are opening like the mouth of some great African cat. And I am aware of my heart. It opens and closes its bowl of red blooms out of sheer love of me. The water I taste is warm and salt like the sea and comes from a country far away as health. There's another moment where you're like, I ruined tulips for me for the rest of my life. But can you see, it has to work visually, like
totally.
A red tulip opening like the mouth.
Yeah.
And so if you put this in another poem and it might not work, it might be like a horrible simile. But in the whole context of the poem and of Sylvia Plath's voice and what she's trying to do in here, it totally makes sense, right? And so, she's brilliant. That whole, for any readers, it's called Tulips by Elizabeth, Sylvia Plath. It's simile, metaphor, over layer, layer after layer. If you want to learn anything about figurative language, read that poem in particular.
Great.
Richard Blanco joins us twice a month for Village Voice. He's the fifth presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history. His latest book, How to Love a Country. We're going to wrap things up with Emily Rooney's prescription for our chronic traffic woes, a theme of one of her famous lists.
comprehensive.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter.
I have absolutely no interest.
This would be called Emily's List. Tell us about it.
Emily's List, that Commissioner of Common Sense is back.
Oh, back.
I've had enough discussion about traffic and traffic woes. I'm here to solve them all.
Oh, fabulous.
Oh, yeah. First of all...
Well, take all the time you need, then, if that's the case.
The Mass Pike coming from the west to the east.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one area that you have to have congestion pricing. It makes no sense. It's all these people in one... Everybody is in one car, you know, and there's no carpooling. Half the people are probably going into a dentist appointment that they could have done. That is the one area. Makes no sense.
All right.
Congestion parking coming on the Mass Pike.
Are we okay with that, Marjorie?
Absolutely.
I am too,
all right.
actually.
I'm going to go to the most complicated one for me anyway, which is 93, north and south.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only real solution is that Grand Junction rail station that Deval Patrick proposed years ago. But they got to do something else with 1 and 1A. It's got to be wider. It has to have fewer stops. There has to be some kind of a flyover. As I said, the only real solution is the rail station. Because some people, you know, if you wanted to take public transportation, it would take you 2 hours. Especially, if, you know, going out to our Brighton studios or something like that. You can't do it.
Can't do it.
Now, you know, the problem with widening roads, the experts say, and none of the three of us are experts, even though we pretend we are, that means more cars, not fewer cars.
It's marshland, too. But it's the ugliest road in America, bar none. Route 1, 1A, it's all just urban sprawl, suburban sprawl. It's terrible. You could widen the road.
And
you also need to toll the bridges and parts of 93 coming into the city. Why are they only, I've said this before, but you didn't.
East-west and not north-south.
Yes,
well,
yes.
My understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, one of you two, that you need federal approval.
Well, let's get it.
Well, I don't know if you can get it.
All right, now I've said this before.
Call Donald Trump.
But I'm absolutely right about this.
Yes,
get rid of the HOV lanes. They don't work. They take up too much space. The Jersey barriers have to be moved around every day. Just changing the direction. There's a full-time state trooper assigned to make sure that you don't have a dummy in your car. It's ridiculous. Turn and you, by the way, one of the solutions is to turn the HOV lane into a Route 3 only lane. Because people are jockeying, make that the Route 3 lane. You see what I mean?
What if they said it was permissible to have an inflatable in your car? Would that be acceptable?
All right.
I like the HOV lane.
It doesn't.
It is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. And it barely works.
Okay, I think
and the
it
Jersey
works.
Barrier takes up a whole other lane.
Well, it does.
Boy,
how about
this
one?
Angry
boy,
one.
How about this? You're worked up.
I'm gonna fix the Cape. The Cape traffic.
Oh, yeah?
Let's incentivize people who rent out houses, which millions of people rent out houses to millions of different people.
Mm-hmm.
Incentivize them with some kind of a homeowner's tax break to offer things like Wednesday to Wednesday, Thursday to Thursday, instead of Saturday to Saturday. Every single person is Saturday to Saturday. Why?
Brilliant.
Is that brilliant?
It really is. I have a better idea.
What?
How about like a parking lot? You can only go on the Cape when someone gets off. How about that? You wait in line. There's a sign
that's
that says
good
one car.
All right.
Isn't that a great idea?
Yeah.
It wasn't my idea,
City of Boston.
City of Boston.
Go ahead.
All right.
Mayor's going to be here in 15
Limit the number
minutes.
Of Lyfts and Ubers to a daily number. Each car coming into the city is tracked with a GPS. Once the limit is reached, any Uber driver or Lyft who comes in faces a fine. So you can't come into the city limits unless you're one of the, I don't know, you could assign a number.
And for those who don't know, as we said yesterday, 96,000 individual ride shares a day in Boston. 96,000.
Okay, now, this may surprise you.
Go ahead.
I'm in favor of charging for the parking stickers per vehicle.
Michelle
this, by
Wu.
The way, Jim, you're a big millionaire's tax.
I am.
This is a millionaire's tax because I tried to get the numbers from the city, but the majority of the city does not have stickers. Only the congested areas, Big Beacon Hill, Back Bay, South Boston, Jamaica Plain, Hyde Park, Roxbury. They don't have any stickers
there. Well, that's a great argument.
They have no stickers. Sticker these people. I have no problem with
what
that.
What do you mean?
And
just say you're a homeowner there. You mean stickers that identify
you don't need
you
a sticker to park in.
Okay,
in,
okay.
Only in the higher income areas is what Emily's saying.
So, here's the other thing I would do.
Work,
I would make this. Austin has stickers.
Every sticker is good for every neighborhood, which would eliminate Ubers big time. Because if I go park my car and I'm going to a restaurant or I'm meeting somebody, I take an Uber. Because once you've got a spot, you don't want to move it. But if you could take, your car anywhere where the stickers are allowed, right?
You know, I live right in the Boston
That would Brooklyn, reduce Ubers.
I love it.
On the Boston Brookline line, there are people who have their cars parked in Austin Brighton. They never
of course.
Move them.
Yeah.
I don't know why they even have the
because
cars.
Because they don't want to lose their spot.
All the
but
time.
But if the spot was good in the south end and the north end. All right.
You're on fire.
The Prue Tunnel squeeze. How many times have you been caught in that thing?
Often.
All right. So if you're getting off at Copley, you're pretty good off. But if you're planning to go 93 north, let's say, mm-hmm. you got to be in that right lane. But there is no signage that really explains it until you're well through the tunnel. Because if you're going south, you want to be in that left lane. And that should be almost like a clear pass there. Put up some signage.
Look at Emily's
It's going to help
face.
People.
Great.
I'm coming up with good ideas here.
They're fabulous ideas, and Emily is totally serious about all
oh,
this.
Yeah.
If you could see her,
Storrow
you'd know.
Drive.
Oof. Go ahead.
Put up a game day only lane, or find people, charge them a fee. 36,000 cars come into the city every game day.
Last night, we're driving to the library for our event with Richard Blanco. I called you on the phone because I'm stuck on Star Drive.
Yes.
Because of the Bruins game, it took me 45 minutes from GBH.
Yeah, that doesn't happen as frequently as the Red Sox games.
That's correct, obviously.
It's a summer problem.
I'll give you a secret.
All right.
Don't go on Star Drive.
Thank you very much.
One other.
Excellent.
This
Do you
is
have
big.
Another one?
On Storrow Drive,
yeah,
jail the skirters. I've brought this up before.
The skirters?
The people who get into a lane
oh, yes.
who have no intention of
totally.
Getting off.
Jail them.
Jail them.
Jail them. By the way, don't jail the people that scam the college admission.
What they have no intention of getting off, but they take your lane.
Jail them.
And then they put their blinker on, and they hold up traffic
yeah,
for 10 minutes
jail
while they're
them.
Waiting to get into the... Oh,
jail
I see what you're saying. Jail the skirters.
Seize their car and sell it.
Okay.
On the spot to anybody.
Everybody out there is going, yes!
Exactly. Look at the enthusiasm.
Man, I'm jumping all around
You only
here,
have time for one more quick one.
So many. Save them for next week.
Those were, can I just say
right,
that
I'm
was
done.
Fabulous?
Yeah, oh, good.
That was
I worked
fabulous.
On this.
Emily Rooney is the host of Beat the Press, which you can catch Friday nights at 7 o'clock. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can catch us 24/7 by way of our podcast on iTunes. Our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeli. Our engineers are John the Claw Parker and Doug Shugerts.